Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, brothers, sisters. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Pennsylvania State Representative Jesse White about the shale thing that went through today. What a screw job this thing is. And again, you know, hey, it's who's paying the freight. The drilling industry has been paying big bucks to make sure that they don't get the same tax rate that they have all across the country. Pennsylvania is special. We here in Pennsylvania, we treat our drillers much more hospitably than any other place in the country. I guess almost a 1% tax. Wow. Very, very nice. So we're going to talk to Jesse White about that. Also, Kathleen Sharp's going to be here, the author of Blood Feud. Going to talk about the healthcare industry, really the drug industry, and how basically, you know, just like a high thriller boy, you know, one of the murder mystery, all kind of stuff, intrigue, huge money, really huge money, and you and me, people like us, dying because of it. So it'd be good to talk to her. Also, we're going to talk with Republican presidential candidate and former Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer about his why he hasn't been part of the debates, his vision, how he sees the country moving forward. Also, John Logan, in the third hour, professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, going to be talking about the NLRB and the Boeing thing. Because me, the way I see this Boeing situation, this is probably one of the biggest labor cases in my lifetime. Because this really is going to dictate whether workers have the right to strike or not. If you have the right to strike, then retaliation isn't part of it. And what this whole move from Washington to South Carolina is about is retaliating against those workers in Washington for exercising their right to strike, which is the law. Now, retaliation is illegal. But the Republicans, they don't care about that. What they care about is they care about destroying your right to collectively bargain. They care about destroying your right on the job and taking those things away, handing them over to corporations. Because we need to be, you can say it, more business friendly. So let's get some of the big distractions out of the way before we get to the good stuff. I don't know if you saw it or not, the 21-year-old man from Idaho, Oscar Romero Ortega Hernandez. He was arrested near Indiana, Pennsylvania. He has been charged with attempting to assassinate the president. You look at this and you go, exactly what were you thinking shooting at the White House? So a bullet hit the window. You didn't realize, Oscar, that they were bulletproof windows? You're not going to be able to shoot the president from the sidewalk. And congratulations, you're going to be like the last guy who thought he would shoot at the White House and be charged and inevitably probably convicted and spend an awful lot of time an awful lot of time as a guest of the state. And so today, all I heard the radical right talking about was, well, he was in D.C., and, he's a young guy without a job, so it must be with those Occupy D.C. people. That's what it is. And we should disband that whole thing and kick them all out and make them go home because they're just living in dirt. And I was thinking about this. He got caught near Indiana University of Pennsylvania, IUP. So if I were to use the right-wing logic, the logic that they're using, he doesn't have a job, and he looks like he's kind of scruffy, so he must be with the Occupy people. So if I use that logic, he was caught near IUP. So obviously he was associated with education. So we should defund all education and close all public universities that start with the letter I. Maybe that's a good idea. So anyway, he's got a tough road to hoe for him, and that was our distraction for the day. Also, I'm guessing Jerry Sandusky's probably, since we got to do the Penn State thing now, probably thinking twice about going on national television, proclaiming his innocence, because the story came out today that, you know what? There are people who are coming forward who allegedly were victims back in the 70s. And, we talked about this right from the beginning. I said, once this opens up, once the door opens, the floodgates will burst open, and you will see people coming from years and years ago. That's what we're seeing. In fact, one report I saw said 10 people were coming forward. Another thing I saw, someone here in the Harrisburg area has hired an attorney, said, I saw him on TV and it brought back those memories. And you know what? What in God's name was he thinking? I mean, there's part of me that thinks, well, you can't get any worse off. I'm thinking it's going to get a little bit worse off for him. Because, look, once this stuff takes on a life of its own, I think it's only a matter of time before we see 20, 30, 50, 100 people come forward. I'm really expecting those kind of numbers. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that tonight. If you're interested, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. It will run its course. I'm hoping that, justice will be done. The healing will move forward. And we attempt as best as possible to make things right. But, it's all out there now. It's a matter of seeing how bad it's going to be. And yesterday I talked about Franco Harris, coming to Joe Paterno's aid. I give the guy credit for standing by a friend. There's part of me that understands that and would probably do it for a friend of mine. I think he's wrong, but, it is what it is. I got an email last night that, kind of grabbed my attention, because as you've seen today, there have been occupation events all around the country, from Milwaukee to New York to Los Angeles. And Andy writes a word from the street, a police raid on Occupy San Francisco tonight is possible. The Hun are mounting big numbers of their best shock troops to overwhelm the camp. He says, I spoke to a few people at Occupy San Francisco camp earlier this afternoon. Folks are starting to worry. All of their construction projects, their library, kitchen, etc., could end up in the dump truck tonight. And, there's this, I look at these camps and I say, well, I don't see any problem with them. I really don't. As long as people are doing it in a peaceful fashion and you can reasonably do something to make it sanitary, I don't see the problem with it. Now, the people who are in charge, their problem with it is they can't control it. And anytime a large number of people come together, that scares some. Are there a couple of a-holes out there who are going to cause mischief? Absolutely. And you take care of those people. But you do not, under any circumstances, in my opinion, take away someone's right to peacefully assemble and to protest what they see as injustice. And, you look around and the numbers are out there. You look around and you see the poverty through the roof. You look around, you see the joblessness, you see the homelessness, you see the foreclosure rates going on. And tonight we're going to talk about all those things, because there's more news coming out, and the more you see what's going on, the more you understand why people are upset and angry and frustrated. And at a government that seems incapable, unwilling, and really ineffective. And the question is why? You know, I go back to Democrats keep caving. Now, you name every major decision in the last 10, 20 years, it's always been the Democrats giving. It's always been the Democrats giving, which ticks me off, because it shows to me that most of the time they don't have a spine. But it also tells me that they don't have a scorched earth mentality, that they're not willing to burn the house down for their principle. They're going to save the house, even if it isn't the way they want it built, they're still going to save it. As for Republicans, they don't mind burning it down. And I think you can look at the jobs bills that they've put forth, if you can call them jobs bills. I mean, I'm not quite sure how deregulating, the energy sector, the oil industry, or deregulation creates jobs in general, other than catastrophe. Deregulating Wall Street, what did that do? Did it create a lot of jobs? Maybe in the prison sector, maybe in the food stamp line. But was it positive? I mean, have you seen positive change out of deregulation? Have you seen positive change out of more free trade policies? I haven't. What deregulation has done for me is it's lowered the standard of living. I was a truck driver for years. When Carter signed deregulation and Ronald Reagan put the pedal to the metal, you saw the trucking industry go from a job where people could make a solid middle class existence to one now you got people living in these trucks like animals. I mean, the book Sweatshop on Wheels is an apropos title. And in that book, he talks, and this was written back in the mid 90s. He said, back in 1979, there were 16,000 trucking companies that employed people, had decent wages, most of them unionized. Back in the mid-90s, you had 750,000 trucking companies. And, but we love competition. And, yeah, competition is good when it's done on the right things, when it's done on who provides the best service, who does the best on time, the best quality. Not on who's willing to slit each other's throats for pennies, which is what's happened in the trucking industry. And now that we're opening up the Mexican border, introducing even more cheap labor, it's going to get even worse. So, again, I'm not seeing where the deregulation is doing us any good. And I don't know how anybody could look at NAFTA and say that was good for the country. It was good for the 1%, which is why these people are out in the streets protesting, why people are out in the streets saying, let's take care of America first. Last night we talked about China. Massive trade deficit with China. And whose fault is that? Not the Chinese. They're the smart ones. If we're allowing them to get away with it, I'd do it too. We're the dumb ones, because we have this bizarre belief in, the invisible hand and free trade, open borders, except for people, of course. Just goods and services. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And we'd love to hear your opinion. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Jesse White. Stick around. Right back after this.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. New York City cops in riot gear attacked the Occupy Wall Street encampment in an ugly pre-dawn raid, arresting hundreds of protesters and an unknown number of journalists, including reporters from the New York Times and Associated Press. Rebecca Mansky of the Occupy Wall Street media team says that a New York judge's temporary restraining order to stop the attack on the Occupy Wall Street camp was ignored by the cops.
Beth Bogart, who's on our press team, she went down there to wave that injunction in the face of the NYPD, and guess what happened to her? She got punched in her right eye, knocked to the ground by a police officer, something she'd never experienced in her life in all these years that she's been active.
SEIU's 32BJ local has begun contract talks for 22,000 commercial office building cleaners in New York City. Local 32BJ's Matt Nerzig.
All we're trying to do is continue an ongoing relationship with the real estate industry here in New York to make sure that these men and women who keep some of the cities and some of the world's most famous skyscrapers and office buildings clean, to give them a contract that secures their income and their basic benefits so that they have enough to get by in New York.
This is part of a national effort by SEIU to transform jobs into good jobs to the benefit of both workers and the general economy.
This particular campaign is connected to many other campaigns around the country and part of a really an overall nationwide effort to secure the good jobs that we have and to see what we can do about adding new good jobs to the economy.
Target workers are pushing back against plans to open stores at midnight on Thanksgiving. Jesse Russell reports.
Target employee Anthony Hardwick of Omaha, Nebraska, started an online petition that has generated more than 100,000 signatures asking Target CEO Greg Steinhoffel to reverse his decision so employees can fully enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday with their families. Hardwick says the decision to open doors at midnight, to essentially be the first store offering holiday sales on the biggest shopping day of the year, requires many employees to be at work by 11 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day. The petition calls for the opening time to be returned to 5 a.m. Retailers have increasingly opened their stores earlier and earlier on the Friday after Thanksgiving in an attempt to maximize the number of hours consumers can shop. Due to many non-retail employers traditionally giving workers the Friday after Thanksgiving off, it resulted in that day becoming known as the first shopping day of the holiday season. The day has also been referred to as Black Friday due to the headaches created by long lines, traffic snarls, and the stress on employees. However, retailers have attempted to claim in recent years that the name is related to turning a profit. The petition calling on Target to roll back its opening hours is posted at change.org.
This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Our tweet of the day comes from Representative Bloom. Up next, he says, dinner meeting with Keystone Chapter of the Association of Builders and Contractors. Their guest speaker, Governor Corbett. So, I mean, you know, hey, if you're gonna throw into it, you might as well go all in. If you're gonna be bought and paid for, be bought and paid for. And good for him. At least he can admit it. That's the first way of curing it. You know, I look at this, I don't even want to call it a solution to this drilling thing. I think it's just it's bad all the way around. It's hateful no matter where you look at it. And you and I are going to get screwed in the end, which I guess is the whole purpose here, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Jesse White to come talk to us about this. Representative White, thanks for taking time for me.
Absolutely. Anytime you can lead off with, we're all going to get screwed, and then you throw it over to me, I feel particularly honored.
I mean, I look at this, and I got to be honest. It's not going to help. It's not going to help education. It's not going to really help the state. It's a pathetic attempt at taxing it just so you can say, well, we did something. I guess I should ask your thoughts first.
Well, I have a couple of many thoughts on this, but there were, and just to clarify for anybody that's listening, you know, the district that I've represented is basically at the heart of the Marcellus Shale territory. We had the first well in Pennsylvania there. A lot of the companies are based here, so I've been dealing with this for about 5 years now. And I can tell you, having been through everything I've been through with this issue, that this was definitely the best bill that money could buy. This was just a terrible, terrible bill. And you know, there's something really, and I think you touched on it, there's something in here for everybody to hate. And I think that's kind of what we saw today.
Except for the drilling company.
Oh, no, they're pretty happy.
I can't imagine not being, because when I looked at it, I saw you're talking about basically about a 1% tax.
Well, yeah, and the financial aspect of it was just really one part of it. And, I mean, obviously, that's the one that's kind of part of the state you're in, is what you'd look to. And I want to be clear about something. You know, I've actually seen there is definitely an economic positive impact to Marcellus Shale development.
Right. You're going to create some jobs.
And I've seen it firsthand. I mean, Washington County is the fastest growing county in the nation in terms of job growth. So, I mean, we really are seeing it, and I don't ever want to, you know, shoot past that or belittle it. But the thing that drives me so crazy, and the people that really are involved in this issue, is that it doesn't have to be this way. It's being put to us as this all-or-nothing proposition, which is that we have to give the drilling industry everything they want, or else, you know, you hate America, you hate jobs, you hate apple pie. I mean, and it's just, it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. This is not an all-or-nothing proposition.
Right, and what worries me, and you've hit on it, it is growing. You're seeing a boom. My problem with booms is you then see a bust. And when you have a boom-bust cycle, who cleans up the bust?
Exactly. And this is an area where we've said is, how do we not learn the lessons from coal?
Absolutely.
How do you, you know, this is Coal Patch Town in Washington County where I'm at right now. This is Coal Patch Town. We have Orange Creeks, or Cricks as we call them out here.
There you go.
You know, we have acid mine drainage that we're still paying a lot of taxpayer dollars to clean up, because 100 years ago, we didn't do the right thing then either. And how in the world could we possibly, knowing everything we know, turn around and make the same mistake again? It's unbelievable.
Well, and this is why, right from the beginning, I thought this should have happened a couple of years ago. We should have been in front of this industry, not behind it, because I think no matter what you do now, it's already too late. The horse is out of the barn. You guys are just playing catch-up at this point, and not really well.
Well, I think yes and no. I think that on the regulatory end, the problem was is that the Marcellus technology and the way the industry was progressing is we have seen an amazing evolution of the issues. So things that were an issue early on have long since been forgotten, and things that we thought were going to be a problem, the industry is correcting themselves through better practices and technology. So I can understand where on the regulatory end it might have taken us a little bit longer. On the financial end, you know, the problem we kept coming back and hearing was, well, you've got to give them time to develop. You've got to give them, they're going to leave. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, they're not going anywhere. I mean, that to me was a ridiculously disingenuous argument. And by the way, you're still hearing that. Now it is, you better give us everything we want or we're going to Ohio for the Utica Shale. Even though they've got hundreds of millions of dollars in potential profits tied up in leases here, we're supposed to believe that they're just going to drop everything and go there if we have the audacity to try to do any sort of regulation whatsoever.
Well, I mean, that is the scare tactic. But at the end of this, the gas is here. And be it tomorrow, be it next week, be it a year from now, 10 years from now, it's still going to be here.
You hit on it. The word you used is really the operative word in all this, and it's tactic. You know, in the areas where I represent, the thing that has frustrated me more than anything out there has been the tactics that have been used by, and I've come to realize in talking with people, in a lot of ways, this is a southwestern Pennsylvania, not unique, but it's a concentrated problem, where certain gas companies and the people that work for them, their tactics and how they go into these towns, and divide towns and divide communities and,
yep,
and basically hold big meetings in the fire hall to get everybody all riled up. And their tactic is real simple. They say, give us everything we want. Your township supervisor better give us everything we want, not ask any questions, or we're not going to be able to drill here, which means you'll never get your royalty payment. So now you've got all of these farmers and people that are leased go into the township, and they said, we don't care about the nuances of the zoning ordinance. We want our damn money.
Absolutely. And it's smart
on
their part.
And that's what you were seeing down here.
And it's smart on their part. I mean, look, you know, they're not spending tens of millions of dollars on advertising campaigns and PR campaigns and all these euphemistically named groups because they just want to be good citizens. No, there's a payoff at the end. This is a psych-op.
Right. Well, yeah, and you use the word. I mean, yeah, the psych-op, story was definitely, when I saw that, I just laughed because I know all those people involved in those stories. I know exactly what they're talking about. And that's absolutely what they were doing. I've sat in those meetings. I would, you know, and the thing that cracks me up, Rick, is when you talk about the big cry from the industry is we need uniformity and we need consistency. Those are the two, you know, the you always know who read their talking points very well. And you know, when you hear those words, it drives me nuts. Because out here, I would have municipalities where they would have an ordinance in one municipality, and a drilling company would say, that is unworkable, unreasonable, impossible, and we're going to sue you if you try to use it. And then the next town over would have the exact same ordinance, and the exact same company would abide by it with no problems at all. But somehow they demand uniformity and consistency, but only when they want it.
Yeah, well.
And it was insane. And what we did out here was, because we saw this coming, those of us that were really involved in this, we saw what was coming, how this was going to all shake out, or some variation of it. We organized, and we put together a group of 18 municipalities in Washington, Allegheny, and Beaver County, and we formed a municipal government answer to the Marcellus Shale Coalition. And the principles were almost exactly the same. And this is a bipartisan group of local township officials, Democrat, Republican, it really doesn't matter, because I can tell you, this is an issue that in a lot of ways, today notwithstanding in Harrisburg, it really transcends party politics.
Absolutely.
When you really get down to it.
Yep.
And we put this group together, and we have held public meetings. We've had hearings on, we had a hearing on impact fees back in August, where we brought in statewide groups. We made it very clear, we wanted to present all sides. We brought in the Commonwealth Foundation. We brought in the Legislative Budget and Policy Center. We brought in all parts of the spectrum because we really wanted to educate people as to what were the impacts. And it was really funny. The Marcellus Shale Coalition came and testified at our hearing, and these were just township supervisors asking them questions. And they said, could you please tell us what are your feelings on the local impact fee? And the representative from the Marcellus Shale Coalition said, well, we agree there's an impact. And someone said, well, can you tell us what it is? Well, no, we can't be specific if there's an impact. So someone said, well, what about roads? Oh, no, we're already responsible for roads. Well, what about law enforcement? No, we're not responsible for that. And anything that a local official listed as a potential impact, the industry was quick to dismiss, largely because they don't want to be accountable.
Yep. And they don't want to be a part of the community. I mean, they love one another. My drilling company is XYZ, but they want no part of being part of the community.
Well, and that's really, you know, when you break down all the component pieces of what happened this week, and it was pretty crazy. And think about it. Here's a scary thought. The drilling industry is probably the only group that had the power to overthrow Grover Norquist in Pennsylvania.
That's pretty amazing.
Can you imagine any other tax that would have gotten every single one of those Grover Norquist pledge signers to reverse course? Even though Grover Norquist sent a letter to all the representatives at 12:15 this afternoon saying, I don't care what Tom Corbett says. To us, it's a tax. And they all voted against him anyway. Now, as someone who has voted, I've put up procedural votes in the past that turned into, you know, flyers landing in mailboxes all throughout my district last year, you know, that were partially fueled by the natural gas industry, you know, fueling the other side and politically, you know, blasting us for, you know, even pretending to sort of kind of maybe talk about taxes. And these guys defied the god of the issue himself, Grover Norquist, and voted for a tax today.
I mean, that is remarkable.
It really goes to show you where we're at in terms of how this industry has controlled that side of the aisle.
And what scares me is, you know, I look at West Virginia and how the coal industry really has that state by the short hairs, and I fear that the natural gas industry in this state will become as powerful, if they're not there yet, but may become as powerful as the coal industry in West Virginia.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel bad in a way, you know, lumping when I say the industry and all this stuff. You know, because, I mean, honestly, there are some companies that, you know, at least on the local level, they do work with us, and they are trying it. And it's so ironic. You know, last year, whenever we voted for the there was the severance tax vote that Rendell wanted to put in, and I didn't like that tax. I did think that rate was too high at that point in time. I didn't think enough of the money went back locally to where the impact was. That was my own, based on where I represent, that was my own opinion. And I voted against it, but just for my own reason. But the day of that vote, you know, we were lobbied by executives from major natural gas companies in Pennsylvania to vote for it, even though it would have been the highest tax in the nation. Because what they told us was they didn't care about the tax because they passed the tax on to the landowners anyway.
Absolutely. And I would argue they've been doing that anyway. You've been paying the tax. We just haven't been collecting it.
Right. And because these leases say point blank, if there is a severance tax enacted, you will be responsible for your pro rata share.
Right. But here's the thing. So, and this is what gets me. You know, and I don't want to badmouth them like you don't.
Right.
This isn't their fault. This is this is your fault. This is the representatives. This is the legislature's fault. This is the governor's fault for allowing it to continue and to get this far out of hand. And you know, I look at this legislation, and again, it's all over the map. When do we start collecting the revenue? Is it this year? Is it next year? How much is it going to be? What, you know, how's it going to help? Who's going to get what? You know, that's stuff that should have been worked out a couple years ago.
Well, yeah, and you're exactly right. And you know, the unanswered questions from this stuff is even worse. I mean, and I was interrogating Representative Baker on the floor the other night whenever they dropped an 85-page cut and replace amendment into this bill. And that's what it ultimately ended up being. And it was shocking. And, you know, some of the most basic issues that we keep saying everybody would come to a consensus, you would think would be able to come to a consensus on, which would be, how do we not have a little extra protection for areas where there's schools?
Right.
A bigger step back or a recreational area. How do we not have those protected? How is there not a component in this bill for jobs? You know,
for hiring Pennsylvanians.
What's that?
For hiring Pennsylvanians. I think the jobs should be people here in local communities.
I hear from the on the ground, you know, complaints from people. And that's what we've heard from real local people that say, look, we've tried to get jobs in this industry, and most of these companies are hiring from outside. And the reasons we've been told by people is a lot of ways, think about it. If you've got a company out there maybe not doing everything exactly the right way they're supposed to be doing it, do you want to hire people that live right down the street and have a vested interest in the community?
Absolutely not.
No. And, you know, so what we and we hear all these, the industry gives us a lot of double talk. You know, I hear two things over and over again. One is that you Pennsylvanians just don't have the work ethic. And I will admit everywhere there are people that don't have a good work ethic. But I can tell you, I know there's a lot of people, I come from an organized labor family, and I've talked with the building trades about this extensively. They're dying to get in on this. But they won't. And they can produce guys that are used to working and can pass a drug test and the whole bit, but the industry doesn't want to pay them a wage.
Yep. Well, we want a minimum wage, and they want to maximize their profits. I mean,
right.
You know, it's what they've been getting away with. It's what they've been getting away with in Louisiana and Wyoming and all these other states where they have this. In Texas, you can hire people for low wage to do this work.
Right. So there's that kind of mentality that Pennsylvanians don't want to do this dirty work. Well, no, they want to do it. They just want to be paid a fair wage to do it. And that's a big complaint we've heard. So there was no money in there for job training. For example, I have the Western Area Career Technology Center right in the heart of this whole thing. It's a Vertex school. They've been at the forefront of developing adult training programs, getting kids ready that if they want to go out, because we realize that not everybody can go to college, or maybe not everybody should go to college.
Right.
Representative Brandon Newman and I have been working together on some youth forum, bringing in the local guidance counselors, and kind of making sure that people really know what it would be like to work in this industry, because we want to enable Pennsylvanians to have these jobs. And, you know, that's the kind of place that Pennsylvania should be investing some training money into. Not one penny for job training. Not one penny to incentivize hiring Pennsylvania workers. Not a single one.
Maybe if you put it under a voucher program.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was funny today, because Mike Turzai, when he's talking about this, when he's giving his final speech about how great this bill was, and it was like I was like looking through the looking glass. I mean, it was insane what I was hearing, and he kept saying jobs, jobs, jobs. And actually, yesterday I was getting robocalls and blast faxes into my office in Harrisburg. And what the callers were saying, you know, because these people, whenever they get these automated calls, they don't really know why they're being told to call. So I started answering the phone myself. And I said, well, what can I do for you? They said, well, we want you to vote for that 1950 because we're for jobs in the natural gas industry locally. I said, well, I'm for jobs in the natural gas industry too. And if 1950 had a component of that in there, I might be able to help you.
Yep.
However, there's not a word of that entire bill. There's not a single word in there about jobs. And, you know, and when people heard that, they said, oh, well, the hell with that.
Let me ask you the last question I've got for you. You look at this. Is there anything good in here? I mean, anything?
No. No. And I want to expand on that. The thing that's really bad, and people need to understand this, is what they did with the local control. Because at the end of the day, the money and everything, that's all dollars and cents, and obviously you'd like to maximize what you can get out of it. But more importantly, and maybe more basic and fundamental, is taking, they took away all the local control. Right now, we had, the municipalities had the ability under the law to pass zoning ordinances to regulate certain things. If you don't live in an area where this is going on, it is really a big deal. Because, you know, it's not just about the wells. Because people understand those, and they're kind of a temporary thing, and they're not there forever. But what we're talking about is the infrastructure of the natural gas industry. Pipelines, compressor stations. Compressor stations are a big deal. They need to put them all over the place to move all this gas around and process it. Meanwhile, these things are designed to last for 50 to 60 years.
Wow.
And they're incredibly noisy. And if they can, for example, they can, and I had one right here in my own township, they can either run on phase three electricity or they can run on natural gas. They can run generators on natural gas. Well, the industry would prefer to run the natural gas generators because it's cheaper for them. Those generators are emitting chemicals into the air. They're making a lot more noise, and they're just not a good thing. The electricity is far better, but it costs them money. We had a company say, well, we can't get phase three power there. But oddly enough, when we talked to Allegheny Power, nobody had ever asked them. So, you know, it's only fair for local townships to be able to pass reasonable setbacks and reasonable ordinances and conditional uses to make sure that these things are going in places that make sense in the community.
Yeah, it amazed me when Corbett came out with they wanted to take away all local control and want to put it in the hands of the state.
And that's what they did. Because here's what they did. They said, okay, we are going to put greater control standards in. So they put in setbacks and things like that, and they're very bad. Like you can do zoning is a permitted use or drilling is a permitted use everywhere. They can put a compressor site 750 feet from your front door. Not good. Not good. It is easier to put a compressor site in a township in Pennsylvania now under this law than it would be to build an addition onto your garage.
Say something.
At home. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It's terrifying. And this is the thing that has the people in this community so upset, many of whom are leaseholders, by the way. So they understand better than anybody because they're actually cashing industry royalty checks. So what happens is they have these really weak standards. And then they say, a municipality, oh, sure, you could pass your own regulations, but they can't be any more stringent than what's already there. Well, what's already there is so weak, anything would be more stringent. So effectively, you can't do anything. And if you do something that they feel is out of line with that is more stringent, the gas companies have the ability to sue the township, which, you know, kind of like a reverse severance tax as far as I was concerned.
That
would get the money flowing the other way.
And you know,
that has an incredible chilling effect.
Yeah, what I find amazing is it was the Republicans who said we need local control. We don't want the state dictating, or on the national level, we don't want the federal government dictating. But here, they're stripping that away.
It was, you know, it was hysterical. In my speech on this last night, a constituent of mine who's a township official out here in Washington County had sent me a quick email. He had suddenly pulled off the governor's website just that day. And it was like a little Q&A thing, and it said, what if I have a problem with my borough about, like, my garbage pickup or something? And the answer from the governor's office was, sorry, there's nothing the state can do. All those issues, including local zoning, are matters for your municipality, not the state. So we suggest you go to your local borough meeting.
Yeah.
And in one fell swoop, they did a total 360. So garbage pickup is so important that we have to have local control. But something like where a compressor station could be put, the locals should have no say in it.
Yeah,
and they knew that this was a terrible thing. Because in the bill last night, I had two amendments. And John Marr from the Republican from Upper St. Clair, who was actually very good on this issue, had an amendment that did something similar that would have reinstated local control. Okay. The Republicans, because they were terrified of a debate on that, much less a vote, they did a procedural maneuver of moving the previous question to the so-called nuclear option. And in doing that, meant that we couldn't even debate the amendment and we couldn't vote on it.
Well, I mean, they've got their idea. They're gonna ram this through. Why do we need all that talking? We're going to do what we want to do. We don't care what you have to say. They've got the votes. And to be honest, I've said this from the beginning. I don't know why you guys show up. They don't listen to you anyway.
Yeah. Well, someone dropped a statistic yesterday that never in any 2-year session of the legislature has moving the previous big question been done more than 4 times ever. This year already in 11 months, they've done it 9 times.
Yeah.
And these aren't on minor bills. How in the world do after all the studies and commissions and meetings and talk, when we're actually there on the House floor debating this issue that really does touch so many Pennsylvanians, how in the world are you that afraid of the reality that you won't even allow the debate? And then you're going to claim to be the party of open government and transparency? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, they're betting on none of their constituents are paying attention. They're betting on, betting on this team sport mentality. I'm Republican and that's my team. I don't care what they do. And you look at this, man. I mean, the Republicans have walked away from the vast majority of their ideology for what? To feed these special interests.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going to be interesting because I really do believe this is one of those votes and one of these issues that history is going to look back. And it may seem a little muddy to somebody now, but in the long run, it will be crystal clear where the right place to be was on this issue.
Yeah.
And there were members on the floor today selling their votes for redistricting or God only knows what else. And yeah, they're going to be sorry for what they did because they really, it was a very short-sighted approach.
This is a done deal, isn't it?
Well, I don't think this bill is a done deal because, and you know, it's so funny to show how far the political climate in Pennsylvania has gone in 1 year. I never thought I'd be saying this, but thank God for the Republicans of the Senate because, I mean, at least, you know, Senator Scarnati, you know, he was the first Republican to come out and even say they wanted to do any sort of a fee or a tax. And, I mean, I'm not saying I agree with his approach wholeheartedly because I don't, but they are definitely, on a lot of these issues, have proven to be the more reasonable body than the House Republicans or than Governor Corbett. And they've kind of been the one to say, okay, we need to be a little more realistic in how we're looking at this. So I cannot imagine the Senate taking up and passing House Bill 1950. I just can't see it. And with the fault lines that exist in the House and the Senate leadership on the Republican side, makes it even less likely. I think that what we're going to start to hear is, you know, and I think the question that someone needs to ask the governor is, which one do you want?
Interesting.
And why?
So maybe it's possible nothing passes and the drillers walk away not paying anything for another year.
Well, you know, there's also a theory that was floated today on the floor with some Republican staffers where they said, we don't care what this bill looks like. We just want to get it out of here. So, A, everybody leaves us alone about it, and B, if the two sides, there's nothing that obliges one side to take up the other's bill. And if they, you know, maybe they bring one of the other bills over and if they vote to non-concur on it, it goes to a conference committee. And you're right, that could take months.
Yeah.
You know,
great.
And maybe that, maybe that is the plan.
Maybe. Great. I'm so glad to hear that my Republican friends are taking care of our state and taking care of our natural resources. Representative White, great talking with you. Love to have you back again. And I got to be honest, I don't know how you guys do it. Talked to Scott Conklin last night. I don't know how you do it. I would reach across the aisle and strangle somebody.
I believe the phrase flip the table has come out of my mouth and more times than a couple. I tend to get a little animated and it's, you know what, there's days like this as bad as they were, or as bad as this week was, that's why you have to do it.
Yep.
You know, because someone's got to at least be there to be fighting this fight. And, you know, we have some very good colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle, and some that need to get a little more real on with reality. And I think if you look at some of the roll call votes for over the last few days, you'll see who I mean. But I think at the end of the day, someone's got to be there fighting the fight, and I'm just glad to have the privilege to be a part of it.
No, I appreciate the work you guys are doing. Keep up the fight, and we'd love to have you back again real soon to let us know what's going on over there.
Anytime.
Representative White, thanks so much. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange. Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say
revolution starts now. I think it's time for change. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at that impact fee, and it's pathetic. It is what it is. It's the minimum that they could get away with. It's pandering to the drilling industry, and we're the ones going to end up being held with holding the bag. Did we learn nothing from history? And that's what's frustrating to me. It seems we haven't. Anyway, our stat of the day comes from the folks over at the Atlantic Wire, who have pointed out that researchers have found that 68% of sons of the top, that upper echelon, that 1% of income earners, 68% of them, at some point by the time they're age 33, have taken a job with the firm that their fathers also worked at. You think about it, it's a lot higher, according to the research, than for the people in the second tier, which was about 55%. And then basically everybody else is about 40%. So you got this thing where, hey, like Tag. Tag Romney got a job with his dad. You bring the kid into the family business, set them up, make sure that they have opportunity, even if they're adults. And you look at this latest Reuters report. The number of children living in poverty has risen by a million people in 2010, according to census numbers released today. You look at this number, nearly a third of all children in this country live in poverty. Mississippi was the highest, Washington, D.C., New Mexico, and they were rounded out by Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, West Virginia. All states that, Republicans want us to emulate as a nation. You see all these Southern Republicans saying, you need to have economies like ours, need to be right to work states. Yeah. State with the lowest child poverty rate, New Hampshire with 10%. So you got all these states with almost a third. It's scary stuff. Thanks to the people over at Fox. According to Fox Nation, had an interesting tweet where they said, God bless income disparity. And they're actually happy that we have income inequality here in the country. And, to a point, I think it's good that Fox has really taken the position of being the television station of the investor class. We've already got the newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, now Fox News, owned by the same people. You gotta make that connection there. Very happy about the income disparity. But you look what's going on around the country with all these occupations, and it is moving the conversation. I mean, now Fox is thanking God that we're in the situation we're in, because, they're the ones profiting from it. But even people like Paul Ryan have had to take a look at it, and he released a report, that actually cited the growing income inequality, and actually put a chart from the Congressional Budget Office in there that showed what we've been talking about for a couple of weeks, that the top 1% saw their income grow by 275% from 79 to 2007, while the rest of us, not so well. And the right, and then part of what he did, and you got to give him credit, he's true to his ideology. And the right really tries to push this idea that, and this frame that, you're just not working hard enough. See, you could be like us if you were smart enough. You could be like us if you didn't make bad choices. You could be like the children of the 1% who go, 68% of them go work for their father by the time they're 33. And not at the bottom rung either. They're not the ones sweeping up the floor. But that frame's out there. You're just not working hard enough. When you hear about the folks on Wall Street, the kids, the people around the country who are out in the street, they're not working. Most of them are working. But they're working 2-3 jobs, and they're crummy jobs. You just don't want to work. That's not true. People want to work, but they also want to be able to support themselves. And you look at the number. It just came out. Demos just released this chart that shows that young adult males have seen their incomes since 1980 drop by 10%. And females have actually seen theirs go up by about 17%. So you got good news that the gender gap is closing, but the bad news is it's closing because the income for men are declining. So what's happening is you're seeing this, everybody's kind of being tapped down a little bit. Women's incomes are coming up because they were so far down. And people are struggling. And what do we get out of the Republicans? We need a balanced budget amendment. We need to cut spending. We need austerity. That's how we're going to grow the economy, by shrinking it. And nobody's been able to explain to me how that's going to look. I mean, you look at what's going on in Europe. And, in fact, they just had a really good piece in The Independent today by a guy named Andrew Grace, who comes out and says, look, I think they've finally woken up and realized that unemployment's going through the roof. Unemployment for young people is at record levels. We've done all this cutting. We've done all this these spending reductions, and it's only made our debt problems worse. It's only made our unemployment problems worse. It's only made the strain on the social safety net programs worse. So we got to start having programs to get people back to work. So they're coming around to the realization, what I've been screaming about since the beginning of this recession, since the beginning of the collapse, which is you need to get people back to work, and you need to do it now. But here again, you know, when you've got this idea that somehow austerity works, it doesn't. Stop it. And you look at the numbers that just came out there. Everybody's happy here in Pennsylvania. 13,800 jobs were created in the month of October. We still need another 237,000 jobs to replace the ones we lost during the recession. You know, we got 20,000 teachers that are out of work. You know, it's just, well, it is frustrating. Let's take a quick phone call before we go to break. How are we doing tonight, Farida?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good and getting better every moment.
Yes, I was calling on behalf of Katie Sitt. She's the first person that gave me my first job in organizing. She's taught me everything I've known about organizing, and I think that she's out there for a great cause. I mean, it's not like Philadelphia or anywhere in the country is having jobs pouring out of the wazoo.
Right.
Her to be out there, I think that we should really rally around to help her get out of jail, you know, really protest, because you have the right to protest. And for her to get locked up over that is like just totally is just blowing my mind right now.
Yeah, welcome to America.
Yes.
You know, we point our fingers at places like China and we point our fingers at places like Egypt and all around the country and say, well, you're not treating your people right. And I look at the mass arrests that went on today, 24 people in Philadelphia arrested for having the march on the bridge that's actually falling apart. I got to give her credit for going on the bridge. I'm surprised it didn't fall out from underneath her feet.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was provide an opportunity for jobs to come to Philadelphia, and these contractors that are coming all over the place from different places, like, we need to start focusing on people that are here on the ground, that are hungry, that are suffering, that are impoverished, low income, all those things. Like, I'm just still like just baffled by the fact that she is in a cold jail for just out here fighting for something that she believes is right. Not just what she believes is right, but obviously 500 other people, including myself. I wasn't able to make it out there today, but I definitely support her in spirit always.
And we support her as well.
That's what I wanted to call for. We really need to work on getting Katie Sitt out of jail, like, now.
There you go. Farida, I appreciate it.
So she can continue on organizing on the ground around jobs and helping this economy get off the floor, because that's exactly where it's at, on the floor, on the ground.
I agree with you. I'm right there with you. I appreciate the update. Thanks so much for the information.
Thank you so much, and you have a good evening.
You too.
Free Katie Sitt.
There you go. Free Katie Sitt. You know, I look at this, and look, you know, they were out there protesting the fact that, look, this is a day of action for the occupation on this bridge, the Market Street Bridge, that's structurally deficient, needs repair, in desperate need of repair. And what do they decide to do? Well, arrest her. Never mind the bridge. Doesn't matter. We can generate jobs by putting people in jail. So we wish the best for Katie and hope her speedy release. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Wind
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin's campaign to recall Governor Scott Walker for his attack on public worker collective bargaining is off to a powerful, robust start. United Wisconsin is spearheading the recall effort. United Wisconsin Board Co-Chair Lynn Freeman.
We have a database of over 210,000 interested citizens of the state of Wisconsin who'd like to recall the governor. We are our volunteers are over 7,000 strong. We've participated in circulator training sessions all over the state for the past few weeks. Right now there's more than 9,000 people trained to be petition circulators. We are optimistic that we will get well over the 540,000 plus that we'll need to demonstrate the point that the citizens of Wisconsin do not want Scott Walker to be their governor.
We Are Wisconsin, the state Democratic Party, and RecallWalker.org are some of the other groups that are very active in the recall. Three Republican state senators are also being recalled. Recall Walker parties and events are being held statewide. This Saturday, the recall movement will hold a huge rally in Madison. 1 year and 6 months ago, BP's Deepwater Horizon suffered an explosion, killing 11 workers, sinking and creating the largest oil spill in the history of the United States. Jesse Russell reports on a study of the impact of that spill.
It wasn't until September 19th of last year that the well was officially declared dead. During that time, and for months after, a massive cleanup effort was waged in the Gulf of Mexico to save a region still reeling from the impact of Hurricane Katrina nearly half a decade earlier. Now the National Institute of Environmental Sciences is on the lookout for workers who took part in that cleanup effort to study and diagnose possible health effects from exposure. According to the Tri-Parish Times, the institute expects to see nearly 55,000 participate in the study. They aren't limiting the study to only cleanup workers. They want to talk to anyone who may have been exposed at a cleanup site for at least one day. More information is available at nihgulfstudy.org.
200 members of IAM Local 516 are on strike at Manitowoc Crane in Wisconsin. IAM Local 516's Ben Elizondo says the strike was triggered when the company took a page from Scott Walker's union-busting playbook and tried to attack the basic union structure by ending dues checkoff and forcing workers to vote every year to keep union representation.
That's our opinion, because at first they had proposed to allow members to vote every October as to whether or not they wanted to pay dues and belong to the IAM. Which pretty much mirrors, Walker's thing about once a year voting, as to whether you want to be in the union or not.
This newscast made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Ever check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Sometimes you wish there were some people watching. I look at some of these stories about these big drug companies and the shenanigans that go on, and you go, where's the oversight? Where are the regulations? Where's the cop on the corner? You look what's going on in the streets. Now you got cops everywhere watching everything that happens. But these big multinational corporations, these big special interests, well, they seem to be able to walk away completely unscathed. It's amazing stuff. So when I saw this book, Blood Feud, written by Kathleen Sharp, talking about this drug Procrit and all the shenanigans and all of the stuff that went along with it, I started thinking it sounds like a Hollywood movie, which is why I've asked Kathleen Sharp to come on the program, talk about her book. Again, her website, KathleenSharp.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on her name. Kathleen, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Rick.
I look at this book, and, as I was flipping through some of the pages, I'm going, it sounds like a Hollywood movie.
Well, it is a true life thriller about two guys who go on a, road trip, and then things go awfully bad. It talks about this drug that all of us should know about because it's one of the top Medicare reimbursed drugs, a drug that was, I'd say it sold globally about $100 billion worth over the last 20 years.
I actually remember this drug. My grandfather was on dialysis for several years, and he, my aunt had fought to not let him take it. It was
really
one of the things that happened.
Well, that's fascinating. Yes, because this was one of the first biotech blockbuster drugs It was known as EPO, and it had several brand names. The one I talk about a lot is Procrit in the book. But what this drug did was really amazing because it helped the body reproduce red blood cells. And for you and I, who are really healthy, that's not a big deal. But as you pointed out, like for people like your grandfather who are on dialysis, or for people who are undergoing chemotherapy treatments, you know, their bodies get really anti-anemia. And so this drug helped their bodies produce red blood cells and, you know, feel better and be able to go about their day.
So aside from being, you know, a thriller and a drama, this is a real-life story of a drug company who, and look, I don't want to bash drug companies who make new drugs that help us, but it sounds, from what I've looked at, a lot of corners were cut, a lot of backroom deals, a lot of shenanigans.
Yes, and indeed, this is not unlike most of the companies doing business today in the pharmaceutical industry. What Johnson & Johnson and Amgen did was just as important as what they didn't do. And what they didn't do is test this drug safely in a large patient pool when they were asked to by the FDA, first in 1993, again in 1996, in 1998. And even to this day, they still have not tested it at the approved levels for patient safety. So here you have one of the most reimbursed drugs in Medicare history that's still being doled out to people, and you and I as taxpayers are paying it through Medicare, and also we're paying for it through our insurance premiums. You know, it's one of those drugs that never attempted, you know, that didn't ever work for a disease that never really existed.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, if the company got away with it, whose fault is it? I mean, to me it sounds like this is a failure of regulation. This is a failure of the FDA to properly oversee what they were supposed to be doing.
Well, you know, that's what I thought in the beginning. And when I went to the FDA and actually started reporting and going through the halls of Congress, I realized that the regulators have been sort of co-opted by those they're supposed to be regulating. For example, in the case of EPO, there were many people inside the FDA who wanted to send harsh warning letters to J&J and Amgen, telling them to you know, stop advertising directly to consumers and stop pretending that this drug was safe when it really hadn't been proven so. And yet, inside the FDA, in the lawyer's office, was a top pharmaceutical attorney who was now the chief counsel for the FDA. And he's the one that said, hey, back off, staff members of the FDA. We don't need to send those letters out. And so the staff itself at the FDA was really demoralized because they were trying to do good, but they got sort of, you know, thwarted at nearly every turn.
Yeah, because that guy might need a job at some point down the line, and maybe he's going to go work for Big Pharma. Like, I remember the prescription Part D plan that they ran through, and I remember the congressman from Louisiana, Billy Townsend, I think his name was.
Right, the man from the Louisiana swamp.
Yep.
That's right, and they he helped push through that $600 billion pharmaceutical giveaway in which it's illegal for the government to negotiate for the lowest discount prices for us. So we're about the only institution in the whole world that pays the high sticker price for drugs, which is ludicrous.
And these are the people who talk about the free market and competition. But the story continues. Representative Townsend not only rammed this through, he quit as a congressman and went to become the CEO of Big Pharma.
How about that? Yeah. And you see this time and time again with this revolving door where, you know, politicians who take pharmaceutical money are actually helping these companies do egregious things to consumers and patients. But that's why I love these two guys, you know, Mark Duxbury and Dean McClellan. They were good buddies on a road trip who, you know, that suddenly went bad. And at first they really believe in this drug and think that they're doing well. But then they see how J&J and Amgen start to cut corners and start to undercut one another. And they see how J&J is teaching the reps how to show doctors and hospitals how to cheat and file false claims. And Mark Duxbury was the sort of guy that couldn't go to sleep at night if he saw some wrongdoing. He had to report it. And, boy, he has tried to report it for the last 15 years, and so far there's been no accountability.
And this is one of those things that, you know, we keep hearing about, well, we don't need regulation, we don't need the regulation. I read a story like this and I go, this is exactly why you need a cop on the corner. This
you
is the reason you need
do.
Regulators.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't leave your back door to your house totally unlocked, but that's what we're doing sort of as a country by allowing these huge multinationals to come in and sort of rip off consumers. And this is what made Marx so angry, because, like all of us, he was taught that there really is justice and liberty for all. But once he tried to execute that as a whistleblower, he found that you had to have access, that you had to know somebody, that the average consumer really didn't have the rights that our Constitution tells us we do.
You know, you bring up the whistleblower, and I just recently the Republicans tried to ram through a whistleblower bill that basically was going to gut any protection for whistleblowers and take away any financial incentives, because, you know, there's some incentives there, because basically you're now unemployable, so you're going to need a couple of bucks to live off of. They want to gut all of that, and basically anybody who's going to come forward in the future, you do so at your own peril, which is, I guess, how these companies want it.
Well, yeah, and when you read Blood Feud and you understand what Mark Duxbury went through, I mean, I would think you might be blown away, because when he stood up and started to tell the directors of J&J that the company was cheating, and he went to the SEC, he first lost his job, he lost his ability to pay his mortgage, he lost his wife and his family, and for a time he had a nervous breakdown and actually lost his mind. So these people really do pay a high price, yet they seem to be the only ones willing to step forward and, you know, try to set things right.
A conscience is a dangerous thing, I guess.
I guess so. But on the other hand, the one thing I love about these two guys is that they have this great sense of humor. Like Mark Duxbury, as a salesman, he would wear these loud ties that had condoms and prescription pills, and you know, it was sort of an icebreaker for him with all the nurses and doctors that he sold to. And Dean McClellan, his good buddy, was operating down out of Tucson, and, you know, he had jug ears like Cary Grant or someone, and he was the type of guy that would drink anybody under the table at any of these pharmaceutical resorts, and he would take all these doctors on all these boondoggles and just be happy to wine and dine them. But at some point, both these guys realized that this was a crooked game. And so one night, what they do is Dean McClellan had all these 15,000 pieces of documents and photographs, and the two guys go out in the desert, and they empty all their boxes and take it to a Kinko's, and they spend all night Xeroxing copies of all these damning documents, and then they bring it back the next day so that J&J has no idea that any of the files are missing. And that becomes the heart of the whistleblowing case, as well as the heart of this book. You know, that's how I was able to describe blow by blow all these amazing conversations that these guys had.
Yeah, it's again, the book is Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever, written by Kathleen Sharp. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com, or you can just go to kathleensharp.com to get a copy there. In fact, we're going to give out a copy of it to the first person who emails me at rick@therickssmithshow.com. We will get this out to you, because I think it's a great book.
Thank you.
And one of the things that caught my attention is I remember, again, I'm kind of a movie person. I remember the movie with John Travolta. I think it was called Civil Law or Civil Suit.
Civil Action. Yeah.
And the same attorney that he played in the movie, also in this book.
How about that? Yeah, Jan Schlickman makes a return. And the way that happened is that when Mark was looking for help, you know, he had no idea there was something called a whistleblowing law. But one morning he opens the newspaper and he reads about Jan Schlickman, who was the hero in the Civil Action, which, as some of your listeners might remember, is the story about two companies who had polluted some water in Massachusetts so much that children were dying from cancer. However, that case almost broke Jan both financially and emotionally, and he swore he'd never get in the law again. But once he heard from Mark Duxbury and heard about this amazing tale of Johnson & Johnson, the most admired company in the world, actually putting out a drug that they knew was harming people, the old fire in his belly rose again, and he had to take on this case.
So where is it now? I mean,
that's a great question.
Yeah, are we going to have to read that at the end of the book?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you like to think of it, we are right in the middle of the story. You know, the book ends, I hope, on an up note. But it is to be continued. In fact, in about 3 weeks, I'm going to travel out to Boston and sit in Judge Bobel's U.S. Federal District Court there and watch as J&J and Jan Schlickman sort of duke it out. Is there going to be a date finally set for the trial? Is she going to dismiss this whole case completely? A case, by the way, that is worth about $30 billion dollars in taxpayer money. You know, these guys like Mark Duxbury step forward, and a lot of times they're just cut off at the knees because the Department of Justice doesn't act on all the information that they bring to them.
Yeah, and they they only have so many resources. These companies, they don't run out of time or money.
Right. I know. Some of these attorneys are charging $800 or $1,000 an hour.
So I look at this, and I guess the last question I have for you is, what lessons do we take from this situation, and have we learned any lessons from it, or is it still the wild, wild west with in the drug industry?
Well, it is the wild west. It's sort of, you know, caveat emptor, beware. But what I love is that you see all these people around the country rising up, you know, pretty much telling corporations, we are no longer your guinea pigs. We are not ATMs. And I really am inspired by that, because that's the one thing Mark Duxbury wanted. He wanted people to read this story and to understand that how drugs are affecting us and how there really isn't as much care given to the patient as there much as there is to the pocketbook of these corporations.
Again, the book is Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever, written by Kathleen Sharp. Again, KathleenSharp.com is the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Kathleen's name, and Bill, you've got the book. So thanks so much, Kathleen. Thanks so much for the book and the story. We're going to keep our eyes out and see where this goes.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, and for all your work you're doing.
All right, thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Grim-faced military officers and ashen-faced politicians describe a horrific war zone, with hundreds of people murdered and, quote, citizens under attack around the clock. Some of the politicos say that the situation is so dire that, quote, it may require our military. Like the frenetic Bush-Cheney litany of lies that rushed America into the senseless Iraq War, what we're now getting is a similar burst of mendacity about Mexican drug violence spilling across the border into our country. Rick Perry, the Texas gubernatorial goober, is even trying to make it a presidential campaign issue. It is not safe on that border, he recently wailed to New Hampshire Republicans, suggesting that he might send U.S. troops into Mexico, quote, to kill these drug cartels. Adding to this macho melodrama, two retired Army generals produced a study asserting that spillover violence makes the U.S. side, quote, tantamount to living in a war zone. One of the ex-generals is Barry McCaffrey, the infamous hyperventilating fearmonger who once was America's drug czar. At a press conference, McCaffrey pointed excitedly to hundreds of people murdered on our side of the frontier. Really? Hundreds murdered? No. His source turned out to be a South Texas rancher full of anecdotes about dead bodies found in the brush. But the Border Patrol says these were unlucky immigrants who perished during the past several years trying to enter our country, not recent victims of Mexican cartels. In fact, far from being a chaotic war scene, a study of the 14 Texas counties bordering Mexico shows that the number of murders have actually gone down in the past 5 years. This is Jim Hightower saying, rumors of a Mexican cartel war in the U.S. are nothing but lies by self-serving political opportunists and self-aggrandizing military contractors out to line their pockets.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app, and you can take your class war on the go. Our quote of the day comes from Neil Barofsky, a former federal watchdog for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. All the money we handed out to the bankers. He said, quote, there's a very popular conception out there that the bailout was done with a tremendous amount of firepower and focus on saving the largest Wall Street institutions, but with very little regard for Main Street. He says, well, that's actually a very accurate description of what actually happened. And we knew that. You know, I remember when it all came crashing down. I said, nationalize the banks, break them up, make the people at the bottom whole. That wasn't just for that instance. That's for everything. Because the people at the top, they manipulate the systems to where they end up with all of it at the end anyway. They cause this chaos, and you and I at the bottom, we're the ones who get screwed in all of this. It's the same thing with this impact fee that the Republicans want to ram through here. You know we're going to get held. We're going to get stuck holding the bag. We're going to get stuck in 30 or 40 years cleaning up the mess. And those companies, they will have taken the gas, and they will go. Scott Stringer, Manhattan Borough President, had an interesting statement today. He said American foreign correspondents routinely put themselves in harm's way to do their jobs in some of the most brutal dictatorships in the world, and their New York City colleagues deserve the freedom to make the same choices. He said Zuccotti Park is not Tiananmen Square. Because, you know, we had talked to people who said, you know, when they went in to get the people out of Zuccotti Park, they had the sky, they had helicopters protecting the airspace over top of this little park. There were no reporters allowed anywhere near it. There was nobody of any media people at all. In fact, you know, there's talk is they were actually targeting them to get them out. It's remarkable. And yet, what gives us the authority? What gives us the ability to say, well, you know what, China, you need to clean up your act? My favorite Michelle Bachmann quote today, she says the Obama administration, well, what they want to do is they want to create more violence so they can then turn it around and demand gun control. She said the scuttlebutt is that the reason why they gave these guns is to create more violence on the border so President Obama can call for his gun control. Talking about the Fast and Furious program, it was a dumb thing that they did. But understand that was started under the Bush administration. It was part of the ATF's operation that started during the Bush years. And, you know, because we do it all the time around the world. We sell them things and then try and track where they go. You know, it's not something that Obama just dreamt up, you know, while riding his bike. This is something that's been going on for years. And what's amazing to me is someone who wants to be president, like Michelle Bachmann, isn't smart enough to realize that these kind of things happen all the time. In fact, if you remember Valerie Plame, the person that the Bush administration outed, the undercover CIA operative who the Bush administration outed, that's what she was doing. She was selling arms, and they were tracking where things were going, but they were doing it with nuclear weapons because they wanted to see who was in the market. They wanted to see who the players were, because you got to know who your enemy is first before you can confront them. Instead of taking this policy, which the right seems to be doing now, any foreigners, all those foreigners, they're our enemy. Any Muslim. It's kind of narrow-minded, kind of short-sighted. And I look at this, you got to love these four idiots. The Waffle House Militia. You know, look, hey, if you've got the nickname, if your moniker is the Waffle House Militia, you should probably just stay home. Maybe watch a little TV, have a beer, something. Let somebody smack you around every once in a while. Anyway, today in Georgia, the judge there denied the bond for the four of them. They were arrested back on November 1st, if you remember. The reason they were arrested is, well, allegedly they were plotting to attack government buildings. They were plotting to attack government workers. They had planned on using plastic explosives and ricin, this neurotoxin. Now, their lawyer, which I guess if you have to have a defense, the grumpy old man defense is always the one I usually pick out first. who's just saying, yeah, they're just a bunch of grumpy old men blowing off a little steam. They're frustrated. They didn't really want to hurt anybody. And, you know, it kind of makes me go, all right, there's part of me that says, yeah, I've blown off steam every once in a while. Yeah. But I don't ever remember blowing off steam that I want to blow up a government building and kill government workers. I guess I just never had that. I mean, have you? Have you ever had a moment where you decide, you know what I ought to do? I ought to go blow up a building. No, I've never done that. Nor have I ever decided that I thought it would be a good idea to tweet, y'all, as tempting as it may be, don't shoot Obama. We need him to go down in history as the worst president ever. I don't know. And then he goes on to call, you know, shooting him tempting. You're going to make that? As much as I didn't like George W. Bush, never came into my head. And I guess this is the difference in thinking between the radical right and the rest of the sane, rational people in the country. Our first thought is not, how do we kill someone? Our first thought is not, let's blow things up. Our first thought is, well, you know, how do we change things in a sane, rational way? How do we elect leaders who are going to going to enact policy, going to make people's lives better? I don't really remember ever saying, gee, I'd like to blow something up or shoot somebody. Maybe someday. I mean, maybe it's coming. Maybe if I become a grumpy old man, maybe that will happen. Oh, did I mention the tweet came from, one of the big college Republicans? The head of the Austin College Republicans there. Did I mention that? So good leaders of the future. But he said he was just joking. Just a little joke. Nice. Very nice. Here's a story that I find kind of funny. This right-wing group called the Daily Caller. They run a website and all kind of stuff. They send, you know, people out to do some field reporting. This woman, her name is Michelle Fields, she is a reporter for the Daily Caller, a very right-wing website. Well, while she was covering Occupy Wall Street, things got kind of out of hand, and the police began beating her. Now, the people over at the Daily Caller have characterized the people at Occupy Wall Street as a protest movement generated by riots. They're people who will condone murder and arson, and they've basically condemned it. So this woman goes down there, she's going to cover it, and what happened was, you know, she starts getting beat up. And the police were pretty aggressive, and what ended up happening is the people that she has been writing poorly about actually came to her aid. So I gotta wonder. The next thing we see out of the Daily Caller about Occupy Wall Street, will it be something positive? Nah, I doubt it. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Republican presidential candidate and former Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer back after this.
Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. I've been watching all day what's going on in New York, and I got to be honest, I think the Manhattan Bureau President Scott Stringer reminding Bloomberg that Zuccotti Park is not Tiananmen Square. Probably a good thing. Probably a good thing to remind him of. And our tweet of the day comes from Governor Buddy Romer. He says, instead of jailing corrupt Wall Street bankers and corrupt D.C. politicians, we jail protesters for civil disobedience. And I've got the governor on the line. Governor Romer, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for giving me some time yourself. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking time because I think you're on the right side of this. Yesterday we talked about your statement saying the mayor was standing on the wrong side of history and that he would be a stain on America's long history of peaceable assemblies. I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, I try to be fair. Maybe there are facts I don't know, but I went to Occupy Wall Street, as you know, 4 weeks ago, to listen. I didn't give a speech. I just listened. And I didn't agree with everything that I heard. I thought it was a typical young crowd, kind of scuffy looking and all of that stuff. But I was proud to be an American for people who are concerned about the direction of the country. People who were concerned about corruption could dare stand up in public and be heard. And I was very upset when this mayor and several other mayors around the country coordinated nightsticks late at night,
yep,
and hammered on these young people and completely lost sight of what they were trying to do. It was done in haste. It was done incorrectly, I think unconstitutionally, and I'm not here to give a speech on behalf of Occupy Wall Street. I think some of their solutions are wrong. I mean, they talk about bigger government. I talk about better government. But regardless of all that, Rick, they're on the right side of history, and they live in America where we have the right of free assembly.
Yeah, and to be honest, you look at what's going on around the country, and how can we then go around the world and say you should treat your people with dignity and respect, and people matter what we're doing to our own citizens.
We had a debate in New Hampshire 4 or 5 weeks ago, and I haven't been invited to any of the national debates. I guess I'm not well known enough.
I think it's been a
congressman and a governor. But anyway, in this debate in New Hampshire, one of the questions of one of the candidates for president was, well, what do you think, should America do business with a country whose capital is corrupt? And the guy started to answer the question, no, we shouldn't. And I said, well, let me interrupt a sec. That the capital of corruption is America. Our D.C., our Washington, D.C. I said, the average guy doesn't count. You got to have a big check. And you stand first in line. And that's what Occupy Wall Street smells. I mean, they could be wrong in every solution. I don't care. They smell corruption, and they called it.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons I give you credit for your stance on campaign finance reform. I think one of the worst things that ever happened to this country was the Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United. Till the day I die, a corporation in my mind will never be a person. Maybe when Rick Perry in Texas executes one, maybe we'll consider it. But I'm sorry, it's just not happening.
Well, let's walk through it just a second. Because the Supreme Court said some very interesting things if people would read the decision. They said that corruption is the greatest enemy to a democracy. And they said the appearance of corruption is just as great as the corruption itself.
Right.
Then they went on to say that's why Congress can regulate direct contributions. That's why Congress can require a disclosure of direct contributions. And then they ended this way. They said, but if it's an independent contribution, if it's a contribution that doesn't go to the candidate, if it's a contribution of a third party, if it's completely independent, then it doesn't have the appearance of corruption, and there can be no limits. Okay, that was their logic by a 5-4 vote. Well, look at the practice, Rick.
Yep.
These super PACs that supposedly have no relationship with a candidate are totally illegal. I mean, one of the candidates has a super PAC run by his former campaign manager. The other candidate has a super PAC run by his business partner. President Obama has a super PAC run by a guy that used to work for him. They're completely coordinated and they're completely illegal. If we don't clean up the corruption in Washington, D.C., this country will not grow jobs. This country will not stand up to China. This country will not change its tax code. This country will not be healthy. I think this election is about corruption, and so far, I'm the only son of a gun to stand up and say it.
Well, and again, there's part of me that says that's one of the reasons you're not on the stage, because if Michelle Bachmann is there and Rick Santorum is there, I should be there, and at least you should be.
Yeah, it's strange. I never expected this. You know, as the only guy who's been governor and congressman, as a guy who's built a billion-dollar bank, very successfully, no bailout money, no favors, no winks and nods. I've just been amazed that I haven't been asked to be on a single debate. And they say, well, it's because you're not high enough in the polls. You're only 2%. Well, if you're not on any debates, how can you get more than 2%
exactly
in a poll? Particularly when you don't take PAC money, you don't take super PAC money, and you have a $100 limit. It's a catch-22.
Yep, and that's part of the whole problem, which is why I'm in favor of, and always have been in favor of, publicly financed elections, where we the people, we fund our electoral process, and it's not co-opted and purchased by billionaires and by big multinational corporations.
Absolutely. The way you write the tax code is to see how many checks you get from Wall Street banks, or see how many insurance checks you get, or see how many pharmaceutical checks you get. That's what you're stuck with. Look, this is the way it is in America. And let me give you my experience. I ran for governor of Louisiana 25 years ago. It was a corrupt state. It was who you knew, not what you knew.
Right.
It was how big your check was. It was big oil, big chemical, and Louisiana had the highest unemployment rate in America. Louisiana was dead in the water, the lowest rating bonds. We had infrastructure that was corroding. We had people leaving our state. We had the number of congressmen go from 8 down to 6. Does that sound familiar?
Yep.
That's Washington, D.C. When I was elected governor, with the limits on giving and full disclosure, we raised $1 million. The governor, who had never lost a race, been elected 3 times as governor, raised $20 million, and we beat him. We've got to do the same thing here. I'll not have as much money as Mitt Romney or Rick Perry or Barack Obama, but if I can get 1 million Americans to stand with me at $100 each, Rick, we can take this thing and expose the corruption that is ruining our country.
I think
we are a nation in decline. We're headed headed in the wrong direction, and it won't change until we clean up the political system.
I think what you've just said there is probably the reason that the Republicans have not embraced you with open arms, Governor.
It might be true.
I got to tell you. But, you know, you go back to this Occupy Wall Street thing, and look, you know, the president has not done anything, in my opinion. What would you do differently as a Republican president sitting in the White House?
Well, I would listen. Now, I know that's not a political thing to say, but I would listen to America. I think our president gives a great speech, but when does he listen? I mean, they did health care reform, Rick. There were no doctors in the room. There were no patients in the room. There were no nurses in the room.
There were no single-payer advocates in the room.
Rick, it's a set-up deal. Washington, a scam. I mean, they did bank reform, and it was all about the big banks. Too big to fail is still the law. How about that?
I would have rather gone back to Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall, I would reinstate it the first month that I'm president.
So there's something with Occupy Wall Street you agree with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, I'm a banker. I know that's not a popular thing to me, but I built my bank. It's a community bank. It's not a Wall Street bank. It's a Main Street bank. We make profit. We didn't foreclose a single mortgage. We didn't shut down a single small business person. We actually met with every one of our customers and restructured the debt. You know why I did that? I thought it was good business. That's the way you deal in the real world.
Yeah.
But that's not the way Washington deals. They did bank reform. Now, listen to me, Rick. They did bank reform. The president signed the bill, a bogus bill. Then he went to Wall Street, had a fundraiser at $35,800 a ticket. And guess who was the host? Goldman Sachs. Something stinks in America.
I agree. There's one party. There's the money party. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you.
And look, I'm a Republican, but I'm a prouder American. And it's both parties that are addicted to special interest money.
But I think it goes back to what you said.
President Obama's going to make all this change. Hell, he just takes more money. That's the only change I see.
It goes right back to what you said at the beginning. You're talking about campaign finance. The only way that people get elected is by having a ton of money to run radio and television ads. And if you don't have the money, you are not competitive. And, you know, I look at you, who I absolutely believe should be on the stage with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs there, because, I mean, it's a comedy show at how uninformed some of them are and how really just comical they can be.
It is sad. And, you know, in the last poll in Florida, I was ahead of Rick Santorum. I was ahead of John Huntsman. I was ahead of Gary Johnson. And I wasn't even on the ballot in Florida.
See, not even that hard to do.
This is a joke.
Let's talk about China. Because, you know, a couple years ago I interviewed Hillary Clinton. And I said, look, Hillary, what's going on here is they're eating our lunch. And, you know, I don't mind losing a fight, but I'd like to throw at least a punch in that fight. And she said, look, it's not China's fault. China's doing what we let them do. They're only going to continue to do it until we stop them. And I look at this report that came out yesterday that laid out what I've been talking about for years. They have mercantilist policies. They won't give us access.
Works, Rick. I've been to China many times now. I'm not just talking theory. I'm not talking in the classroom. I'm not talking at the Harvard Business School. I've been to China. I've been in the plants. They work child labor. They work prison labor. They work forced labor. There are no standards for health. There are no standards for safety. There's no standards for the environment. They manipulate their currency. They subsidize special interests. They've already picked out seven industries for the next 10 years,
yep,
including biotech and genutech. I mean, these guys work special impediments to trade. I work with a company in Louisiana that builds fire engines. It took us 9 years to sell a fire engine specifically designed for China. It took us 9 years after the engine was accepted by the city of Chengdu. That's how unfair the trade is. It's worse than anybody thinks. They've taken 3 out of 4 of our manufacturing jobs. You can't find something made in America. And every time President Obama does a stimulus bill, It doesn't help America. It helps China. You go to Walmart, nothing's made in America. You spend this stimulus money, you're buying goods from China. Their unemployment has been cut in half. Ours is still 9%. Is this a goofy world? And you know why it's like that?
Tell me.
The big corporations have never made more money.
Yep.
Here's what they do. They close a plant in America, then they open a plant in China. Our tax code allows them to deduct the cost of the new plant. They fire American workers. They hire cheaper Chinese workers. They produce products there. They don't sell them in China. They sell those products in America. They sell them in America. And guess who Obama's jobs advisor is? The president of GE. And GE paid no taxes last year.
Yeah, but here, let me stop just for a second.
Yes.
You know, it's easy to point the finger at Obama. He's president, absolutely. This has not been the advent of the Obama administration. This has been for the last several years.
Hey, look, don't misunderstand me. Don't misunderstand me. I'm a competitor, and eventually I will face our president. I will do it with honor
grace.
And we'll talk about how to build a better America. And I'm guilty here of laying some things at his feet that he did not invent, but he has done nothing about it either. Let me say that. But this started big time under Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton. It started with NAFTA. We started giving our manufacturing jobs away. And we have done nothing in the years since then to correct it.
We could argue this goes back to Nixon. And then through the Reagan years, there was a lot of discussion.
It goes back 41 years. We have had a trade imbalance for 41 consecutive years. No nation in the history of the world has had that kind of poor performance. And a trade imbalance, Rick, means that we are sending $700 billion a year of our net wealth overseas that will never come back, and nobody's doing a darn thing about it. It is unsustainable.
Yep.
The first order of business for the next president is to look China in the eye and say, we will trade. We are your best market, but trade will be fair or it will stop.
Excellent. And that's what I think has to be talked about, because to me, nothing matters. Nothing gets solved until we solve the money in politics and the massive imbalance
in
trade.
You're right.
And Governor.
Look, it's like we had a big jobs bucket and there's a hole in the bucket. And that hole is unfair foreign trade, particularly China. Until we plug that hole up, we're never going to be America again.
I absolutely agree with you. And, Governor, I wish you the best. I would love to see you up on the stage there. I'm hoping that happens soon. I encourage people to promote the fact that we want you up there pushing these issues, because what we've talked about, we're on the same page with. We may differ on some other stuff, but I think we're on the same page here.
I want you to call and tell me what we differ on. I'm with you, man. Let's go.
All righty. Thanks. Governor Romer, okay. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Former Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer running for the Republican presidential, you figure it out. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org.
We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to contact me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Something on your mind, question, comment, you can also give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Seems like a decent guy. There's some things that I'm not thrilled about, but as far as a Republican goes, and seems like a decent guy, and we look forward to sitting down with him when we head up to New Hampshire in January for the primary. We're looking forward to that. I'd love to sit down and talk with all of them at some point because all of them have really bizarre screwed up tax codes. The idea being somehow we can cut taxes and grow the economy. Somehow we can keep the Bush tax handouts to the top 1%. We can continue to enrich the billionaire class, and somehow we're going to grow the economy. And, Buddy Romer is no different. I mean, he has a very an interesting tax plan, but his is on really restraining government. His idea is he wants to make sure that, and it's an interesting thought, that what we do is we cap the amount of spending per GDP at 18 to 18.5%. Currently, it's about 25%. But the problem is what's happened is the economy is kind of constricted. Things have constricted. So if your spending level stays the same and your economy shrinks, of course, your percentage of debt to GDP, your percentage of spending, of course, then increases. And, his idea is interesting. I mean, don't tax anything under $50,000 and then put a 17% tax straight across. I just don't think you're going to be able to raise. I don't think you're going to raise enough revenue. I just don't think it's possible. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. We got Josh on the phone. He's at the Market Street Bridge. Josh, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi. Yeah, I was down at the Market Street Bridge action today, and I just wanted to say, Rick, first off, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Appreciate it.
And it was a great action today. It was so great to see, a lot of people out there, and I tell you, it's a sin that people have to get arrested to bring light to what's going on. And I want to do a call out. My buddy Dennis Short, he was arrested and he's in jail now. And we're doing solidarity out there right now, right outside the roundhouse for him here in Philadelphia.
Our friend Katie, she was arrested along with it. So you look at the 24 people who were. I got report I've got is 24. Maybe you've got a different number.
Yeah, I'm hearing 24 as well. I mean, you couldn't tell there were so many people, but there were easily 20, 22, 23, 24 people being put into those paddy wagons. So.
And what's interesting to me, again, is choosing the Market Street Bridge to hold your action at, highlighting the fact that we have a crumbling infrastructure. I can't get that out of my head. And what do we do? Instead of saying, hey, we'll fix the bridge, we scoop people up.
It's a shame.
So the people that you've met out there, Josh, I mean, because I got to imagine this is an empowering moment where you're standing with a bunch of people who kind of think in the same way you are. You're all in this action together. A powerful moment, I would assume.
Yeah, it really was. It, It's one of those where it's like, and I have to tell you, it's a diverse crowd, right? It's a mix between, you know, there's adults, there's kids, there's people of color. There, you know, it's a mixed crowd of people, and it's exciting. And it's exciting that people are willing to sit down, you know, and fight.
So these are the people. You're not hanging around with those living in the dirt types, are you? Those people who want to destroy the country and tear down the country because they're so powerful that they're going to destroy the fabric of our nation.
Absolutely not. It was America through and through, you know.
Well, good for you, Josh. I'm thrilled to hear so many people were out. I think we need to. I've been calling for these actions for years. It's great to see people finally waking up and getting out in the streets. And good on you.
All right, thanks, Rick.
Thanks for the call, Josh. You know, look, I've been saying, where are the unemployed? Where are the underemployed? Where are the uninsured? Where are all the people who are left behind in this economy? Where are those people who are struggling to make ends meet? Saying, you know what, the billionaire class is doing wonderfully well. What about us? And, you know, you look at the Republicans who are running for president. And, again, I go back to this tax thing. Because, for me, it's the tax thing that's done this. It's the fact that we've taken the right of workers away to organize and to collectively bargain. But they've all got this tax scheme. And, you know, while I think Romer's is interesting because it's going to have a flat tax at 17% for anyone making over $50,000, I can't imagine what the Republicans would be screaming, because nobody's going to pay tax under $50,000. Maybe what is that, about 60% of the country? I just don't see how you're going to get to it. I don't know how you're going to pay your bills. There'll be no national sales tax, according to him. But he's going to close all the corporate loopholes, which I think is a start. Before you do anything else, that's the starting point. And don't do this nonsensical, oh, we need to lower all the rates so people will pay. No. Greece tried that. Greece tried to say, oh, well, we won't enforce our tax laws. We won't have people go collect the taxes. And look where they're at. That's our future if we keep this idea going. And here's the other thing that's really, really worrisome. This whole balanced budget amendment thing, it's not going anywhere. It's a nice distraction. It's a nice waste of time. But you've got some Democrats who are signing on to this idea. Now, they're those blue dog Democrats who, you know, they might as well be Republicans. But they're signing on to it as well. The idea being, well, you know, we need to restrain government. No, what you're going to do if you pass something like this, you're going to end up killing 15 million jobs. The folks over at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities came out and said, look, you're going to shrink the economy by 17%. And then what will our spending be once you shrink that economy down by 17 more percent? Instead of 25%, it's going to be 30, 35%. And our debt to GDP ratio will go from 60% to 80 or 90%. And this is playing right into what the Republicans want. They want this crisis. This is how they see that the only way they're going to hold on and maintain and grow their power in 2012. Is by looking back and say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago today? And if they can continue to stall, delay, if they can continue to gridlock, this economy is not going to grow. And people are going to go, no, I'm not better off. And when we come back in a bit, we're going to talk with John Logan, a professor out at San Francisco State University, about the other line of attack. Look, if we had strong rights for workers to join and collectively bargain and join unions, We'd have a fair share of the pie. They've done a nice job of stealing that away, and now they want to kill it off. And John's got a nice piece we're going to talk about when we come back. We're right back after this. Stick around.
To the Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin's campaign to recall Governor Scott Walker for his attack on public worker collective bargaining is off to a powerful, robust start. United Wisconsin is spearheading the recall effort. United Wisconsin Board Co-Chair Lynn Freeman.
We have a database of over 210,000 interested citizens of the state of Wisconsin who'd like to recall the governor. We are our volunteers are over 7,000 strong. We've participated in circulator training sessions all over the state for the past few weeks. Right now there's more than 9,000 people trained to be petition circulators. We are optimistic that we will get well over the 540,000 plus that we'll need to demonstrate the point that the citizens of Wisconsin do not want Scott Walker to be their governor.
We are Wisconsin, the state Democratic Party, and recallwalker.org are some of the other groups that are very active in the recall. Three Republican state senators are also being recalled. Recall Walker parties and events are being held statewide. This Saturday, the recall movement will hold a huge rally in Madison. 1 year and 6 months ago, BP's Deepwater Horizon suffered an explosion, killing 11 workers, sinking and creating the largest oil spill in the history of the United States. Jesse Russell reports on a study of the impact of that spill.
It wasn't until September 19th of last year that the well was officially declared dead. During that time, and for months after, a massive cleanup effort was waged in the Gulf of Mexico to save a region still reeling from the impact of Hurricane Katrina nearly half a decade earlier. Now the National Institute of Environmental Sciences is on the lookout for workers who took part in that cleanup effort to study and diagnose possible health effects from exposure. According to the Tri-Parish Times, the institute expects to see nearly 55,000 participate in the study. They aren't limiting the study to only cleanup workers. They want to talk to anyone who may have been exposed at a cleanup site for at least one day. More information is available at nihgulfstudy.org.
200 members of IAM Local 516 are on strike at Manitowoc Crane in Wisconsin. IAM Local 516's Ben Elizondo says the strike was triggered when the company took a page from Scott Walker's union-busting playbook and tried to attack the basic union structure by ending dues checkoff and forcing workers to vote every year to keep union representation.
That's our opinion, because at first they had proposed to allow members to vote every October as to whether or not they wanted to pay dues and belong to the IAM. Which pretty much mirrors, Walker's thing about once a year voting, as to whether you want to be in the union or not.
This newscast made possible in part by the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or about to retire, the Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, intention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
Well, I think that's probably, exactly right. Congressman Rob Andrews from New Jersey, I don't know how much simpler it can be put. Everything that we're seeing, all of these attacks, all of this legislation, all of these laws meant to restrict our right to vote, meant to restrict our right to collective bargaining, meant to restrict our rights as workers and really as people, coming out of the cloakrooms and out of the back rooms of all these think tanks. For years they've been whispering this stuff like giddy little schoolgirls in the back of their cloakrooms. Now they're empowered. Now it's full pedal to the metal. And the NLRB is just the next one on the chopping block. And as I said earlier, this is a huge, huge case. More than that, of much more magnitude than I think most people think. This is the basic premise. Do you have the right to strike or don't you? And they are doing everything they can do to take that away. And our friend John Logan, professor and director of the Labor and Employment Studies Program at San Francisco State University, has written a great piece over at The Hill, Labor Law for the 1%. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Pleased to be on.
I look at this this attack that's going on against the NLRB, and for me it comes down to that basic premise. Do you or do you not have the right to strike in this country?
The latest Republican bill, this ludicrously mistitled Workforce really just another in a long line this year of attempts to make it more difficult for workers to join a union and to engage in collective bargaining. We've seen 24 of these bills this year alone that that limit the authority of the National Labor Relations Board or amend the National Labor Relations Act in a way that would weaken already weak labor rights. And, you know, they've spent endless hours, 12 hearings, letters demanding a subpoena, the documents from the board, request for interviews of career employees. It's cost goodness knows how many millions of dollars in time and not one job created as a result of it.
You know, I look at this and, you know, some of the people we've talked to, Boeing knows, from the people who we know, who are kind of in the know, say that Boeing knows they're going to lose this.
Well, Boeing, before the NLRB issued the complaint, and it is at this point only a complaint, there's no decision in the Boeing case, but of course Boeing and the Republican allies in the Congress are unwilling for the process simply to run its course. But Boeing warned, and we now know from documents that were actually released as a result of a freedom of information request by a right-wing organization, we know that Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican of South Carolina, warned the NLRB that he was going to come at them, and his words, all guns a-blazing, if they issued this this complaint. So Boeing said that rather than accept a settlement with the union, they would prefer to go to Congress and to stop them going ahead with this complaint. And you know, you have to give them credit. I mean, they've come good in their promise. They said they were going to come after them politically. They were going to take it to the media. They were going to do everything they possibly could to turn the NLRB into a symbol of, you know, this right-wing fantasy of you know, Obama's job-killing regulatory agenda. And that's exactly what they've done. You know, I mean, there's no truth in it whatsoever. You know, the simple question in that case is, did Boeing violate the law? And there's compelling evidence that they probably did. But say that, you know, that case is still being heard by an administrative law judge in Seattle. But rather than allow that to happen, the Republicans have decided to use the board as a symbol for this job killing radical pro union agenda. It's complete nonsense.
Well, it is complete nonsense.
If you look at the legislation, I mean, the worst thing about all of this, John Klein, the Republican from Minnesota, who's promoting this ludicrous bill, had an op-ed a few days ago saying that how reining in the NLRB was good for workers. So, you know, they have the audacity to say that they're actually doing this in order to benefit workers. So they're actually trying to destroy labor rights in order to benefit workers.
Yeah, but again, you know, there's this, the big lie theory. If you say it enough, there are going to be some people who buy into it. And, you know, this whole media campaign, you know, you look at all these right-wing programs, all of these websites, all of this infrastructure that they've built over 40 years,
yeah.
This echo chamber that they have that just keeps repeating this stuff ad nauseum, when the reality is, the bottom line to this is Boeing, they moved from Washington to South Carolina for one rational reason. They wanted to get away from the workers and the people who had the right to strike and who had struck in the past. There
sure.
is no
and
business.
So, I mean, one of the top officials from Boeing said so openly in a televised online interview with the Seattle Times, said the principal reason for the moving was not the business climate, was not the starting wages, but was because of the union. Because they didn't want to deal with another strike. And then internal documents openly talked about this, that this was a major attraction from South Carolina, that they would be operating non-union there. So, I mean, and, you know, this is clearly in violation of the law. It's a perfectly straightforward case of retaliation for exercising a protected activity, in this case, the right to strike. But, you know, that sort of prosaic reality has no place in the current GOP completely over the top and disingenuous rhetoric on the board, on the National Labor Relations Act, on labor rights and collective bargaining.
So I look at this and I go, you know, just from a purely common sense point of view, a logical point of view, what sense does moving to South Carolina make? You're moving away from all of your knowledge. You're moving away from all of your infrastructure. You're moving away from most of your suppliers all the way across the country. It makes no logic. It makes no sense other than what you've laid out. It's retaliation. So what the Republicans had to do and what they are going to have to do is figure out how to change the message, which it's, like you said, it's job killing. It's overreaching. And we've got to destroy it. So we're going to slash its funding. We're going to make sure we don't appoint anyone so the board is completely ineffectual and they can do nothing. And, you know, never mind what we've done in the past. But we're going to take them out now and finish them off.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the most telling attacks has been the completely hysterical reaction to the board's new rule on notice posting, so that employees actually know their rights under the National Labor Relations Act. It's a very simple rule that employers simply have to get a free poster and to display it in the workplace. Couldn't be more straightforward. Very, very little cost involved. Absolutely standard procedure under practically every other labor and employment law in the country. And Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, National Right to Work, and the Republicans now, joined by Republicans in Congress, are absolutely opposed to people knowing their rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And, you know, and I think that's very, very telling, that they actually go so far as to say that, no, it's unacceptable that employers have to post a notice letting people know that they have certain rights under the law.
I mean, I look at all of this stuff, and what it tells me is that in this country we have got virtually no rights on the job. I mean, most states are, you got 22 right-to-work states now. You've got, most states are at-will employment states. There's very little that protects workers anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, as you said, I mean, the rights are already incredibly weak compared with the workplace rights in any other developed democracy in the world. And yet, you know, these very, very moderate and reasonable attempts by the labor board to make some minor changes have been greeted with this hysterical reaction. And it's understandable. The right wing people who are opposed to labor rights, opposed to unions and collective bargaining, exercise a complete stranglehold over the system. So why would they accept any change, no matter how slight, when they hold all the cards, when they control the system as it is?
Yeah, excellent point. You know what I've been watching lately is you've seen some of these right-wing sites, websites going after Leif Solomon for some of his emails. And, you know, as I'm reading some of the emails, and I don't know if you followed this at all, but some of them you kind of question, why did you write this? But it still has nothing to do with the case.
No. And, you know, one of them was responding to these sort of crazy op-eds and editorials, and as you say, all of the right-wing think tanks and all of the others suggesting that the board was responsible for wrecking the U.S. economy. And, you know, and he made a joke about, okay, we've wrecked the U.S. economy, let's now go over to Europe and do the same then. And, you know, clearly was a response to this, completely insane interpretation of the impact of the Boeing complaint. And, you know, they actually have used this as to suggest that, you know, he's admitting that, you know, that they actually have had this impact. You know, course, was the opposite of what he was saying in the email. But, you know, just the way that this stuff, as you said, I mean, it beggars belief how it's reported. And, you know, the truth is precisely the opposite from what is being said. But, you know, that unfortunately, that doesn't seem to matter. You know, labor rights in this country are incredibly weak. Unions were at a stage, unfortunately, that have are very, very weak and lacking in influence. Again, you know, you compare this with any other democratic country, democratic developed country in the world. There's no question that the unions are, you know, in the private sector, on the verge of you know, complete irrelevance in this country. And that, you know, listening to these people, you know, it's the labor board and the unions and not you know, powerful corporations like Boeing that wield dangerous political power. You know, I mean, it would be laughable if it were not the fact that, you know, unfortunately these people to a large extent are controlling the both the debate and the political agenda.
Yeah, we really have fallen down the rabbit hole. And as you point out, you know, it's amazing how the Republican worldview on labor rights has the unions intimidating workers and not the employers when yeah. the evidence, as you point out, is overwhelming.
Yeah. And so, I mean, again, you know, they are opposed to this NLRB new proposal to streamline the union certification process to try and get rid of this problem of excessive delay and of employers who use delaying tactics to undermine employee free choice, which is unfortunately too common. And but, you know, they justify opposing an attempt to strengthen employee free choice by saying, no, you know, we have to guarantee that, you know, these elections are as long as possible, so that employees can get to hear both sides of the story. And, but in reality, what they mean is so that employers have as long as possible to conduct these very aggressive anti-union campaigns, which is very well documented that happens in the overwhelming majority of cases, that so that employees are subjected to you know, sort of captive audience meetings, the one-on-one meetings with supervisors, the anti-union flyers, the anti-union videos, so that they have, employers have, and their consultants have maximum time to coerce and to intimidate and to you know, really instill fear in anyone who wants to form a union and to engage in collective bargaining. But they claim to be doing this, again, you know, for the benefit of employees. And as I say, you know, it would be laughable if it were not for the fact that, you know, let's say that these people really have been controlling the debate.
It's tough love. It's tough love. We're beating you. We're beating you for your own good. We're going to fire you for your own good. That's what it is. The story is Labor Law for the Top 1%, written by John Logan over at The Hill. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on John Logan's name. John, always great to talk with you. You keep up the great work over there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Bye. Let's take a quick break right back after this with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Why think about the unions again? They have all died away. We are now in the midst of a brand new world economy.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Grim-faced military officers and ashen-faced politicians describe a horrific war zone with hundreds of people murdered and, quote, citizens under attack around the clock. Some of the politicos say that the situation is so dire that, quote, it may require our military. Like the frenetic Bush-Cheney litany of lies that rushed America into the senseless Iraq War, what we're now getting is a similar burst of mendacity about Mexican drug violence spilling across the border into our country. Rick Perry, the Texas gubernatorial goober, is even trying to make it a presidential campaign issue. "It is not safe on that border," he recently wailed to New Hampshire Republicans, suggesting that he might send U.S. troops into Mexico, quote, "to kill these drug cartels." Adding to this macho melodrama, two retired Army generals produced a study asserting that spillover violence makes the U.S. side, quote, "tantamount to living in a war zone." One of the ex-generals is Barry McCaffrey, the infamous hyperventilating fearmonger who once was America's drug czar. At a press conference, McCaffrey pointed excitedly to hundreds of people murdered on our side of the frontier. Really? Hundreds murdered? No. His source turned out to be a South Texas rancher full of anecdotes about dead bodies found in the brush. But the Border Patrol says these were unlucky immigrants who perished during the past several years trying to enter our country, not recent victims of Mexican cartels. In fact, far from being a chaotic war scene, a study of the 14 Texas counties bordering Mexico shows that the number of murders have actually gone down in the past 5 years. This is Jim Hightower saying, rumors of a Mexican cartel war in the U.S. are nothing but lies by self-serving political opportunists and self-aggrandizing military contractors out to line their pockets. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and moderate. Father, son, left a cameo, blue denim, head is vain.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thought, question, comment, something on your mind. Our quote of the day comes from Derek Cressman, Common Cause Regional Director of California Watch. He writes, if we want a government of the people and by the people, you'd want 99% of the members of Congress coming from the 99% of society. That's not worth $9 million. They just came out with a report that says Congress, 11% of the members of Congress have net worths of over $9 million. And the number of millionaires in Congress is over half. So you look at these numbers, these are the people who are making the decisions, the people who are sitting in our halls of Congress and holding the levers of power. They're not us. This is the upper echelon. And it's one of the reasons that I'm not in favor of a temporary or a part-time legislature. One of the reasons I'm not in favor of a lot of the things, the ideas that come out. I wish there was a way that we could get average everyday people to be able to serve. A part-time legislature would never work unless you mandated some type of like we're supposed to with military service. But as we've been seeing, that's not foolproof either. So, how do we get more people like you and me? How do we get more people who live lives that represent the majority of the people in this country? How do we get them into the halls of power? How do we get them making laws that help us? I mean, you look at these trade policies. I don't know any working person who goes, yep, South Korea was a good idea. I don't know anybody who thinks Colombia was a good idea. Panama. I don't know anybody who thinks I don't know any working person who thinks NAFTA was a great idea. Now, I do know some big CEO types who think, this is a good idea because we were able to move some production down there and we were able to get cheap labor and bring it back and forth. And it benefited the corporate form, not the human form, which is why I don't think corporations can and should be people. Sorry, just not going there. Some good news coming out of Wisconsin. It looks like they've got, just in 48 hours, they've collected some 50,000 signatures that they, now look, they still need over 500,000 signatures But, you know, you start off 2 days, you start off with 50,000 in those first 2 days. That's pretty good stuff. They need 540,206 valid signatures in the 60-day period to recall, to have a recall election of Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, and also the lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clefish. So Rebecca Clefish, she's going out making this plea. And she says, you know, there might be a day when someone asks you for your signature. Signing a recall petition, she says, is like saying you're okay with spending $7.7 million on another recall election. $7.7 million may already be allocated to merit raises for teachers and health care for the poor or school books for your children. Signing a recall petition is like saying you're okay with taking money away from those things and spending it on another special election. And I'm sitting here, my mind's about to explode. Like she gives a rat's behind about raises for teachers. Like she cares about health care for the poor or books for school kids. Are you flipping kidding me? What this is, you know, again, it's political pandering. It's, you know, trying to tell that person in the middle who, like me, doesn't want to waste taxpayer money. But there's some points that have to be made. And getting her and Walker out, those are points that have to be made. When you have policy that steals rights away from people, when you have policy that kicks people off insurance rolls, when you do what they have done and Kasich has done in Ohio, and when you do these things, there has to be some consequence. And I'm sorry, letting him finish out his term, that's not a consequence. Now look, if he loses and when he loses, he'll be well taken care of. And I'm of the mindset, let him go. Let him go early. Because if you remember, you know, he said he was about creating jobs. Actually, he's cost the state jobs. You know, basically getting rid of thousands of public sector jobs. But in their world, those aren't real jobs. We don't want those kind of jobs. So Mother Jones had this report, which I found interesting. Walker's jobs plan. Mother Jones writes, Walker and the GOP legislature have a plan. First, they curtailed collective bargaining rights and threatened to lay off thousands of government workers, including teachers, cops, and firefighters. Then they called a special jobs-focused session of the legislature, which he dubbed Back to Work Wisconsin. And they passed what they called job-creating laws. And at the top of that agenda, what was there? What was right there? Well, right at the top of the job-creating agenda was gutting the state's sex ed standards. So instead of teaching age-appropriate, intelligent ways for kids to protect themselves, we're now going to the good old abstinence only. That's his job-creating plan. And it's really very Republican if you think about it. It has nothing to do with creating jobs. But what it is it's more... It's more delay. It's more stall. It's more shiny stuff. It's more distraction. And it is what they do after all, because there's nothing there. And they don't want things to get better yet. They want to make sure that, you know, what goes on is they want to make sure that the economy is bad enough so that come next November, you vote for them again. Or you stay home. I mean, if you look at this last election, if you really sit down and break the numbers down, Democrats stayed home. You know, the same number of Republicans came out, but Democrats just stayed home because they got beat up, demoralized, disenfranchised. And I'm saying you can't do that again. You got to get your behinds out. You got to get to the polls and you got to vote. And if someone steps in your face and says, I want this, or I'm checking your credentials, or you better have a photo ID, we need to fight back against those things. Just simple stuff. You need to fight back like they did in Ohio. and like they're doing in Wisconsin. I mean, it's amazing to me what I was just amazed at what I saw happen in Ohio. They really, in the state of Ohio, awoke a sleeping giant. Because, you know, some of the people we talked to were lifelong Republicans. Would have never voted for a Democrat. And now they're like, whoa, now I get it. Yeah, the union's been telling me for 20 years the Republican Party's killing us, and now I see it. Kind of late, but they see it. And then the hope becomes is that you have a sane, rational Republican Party. You know, I look at Romer, and when we talk to him again, we're going to find out what his opinions on labor is as well. What I would love to see is a Republican who's pro-worker. I don't know that we're ever going to see that. There are some Republicans who are labor-friendly. But I would like that to be one of those mutually agreed-on issues, like it used to be. I go back to Eisenhower, who said, you know, basically, if any politician came out against Social Security or the Farm Bill or labor rights, you'd never hear from him again. That's where we need to go back to, where there are things that we agree on as a nation. And we kibitz about the little stuff. The problem is what we've allowed to happen is we've allowed the little stuff to get in the way of the big stuff. We're bickering over the little stuff, and we're bickering over the distractions. And that's what we've got to stop. Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapons of solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep, and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a Senior Blue PPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal, and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can't over the telephone. And it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and across the nation, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you so much.
So the big distraction today is the guy, I guess, took a couple shots at the White House being charged with an assassination attempt?
Yes, not only an assassination of the president, but I guess it's also very heavily against the law now to deal with any staff members directly associated with the president. Obviously, people like that, Secret Service, et cetera.
Right.
And so that is what he's charged with.
I was looking at this, and I kept hearing the right wing going off about how, well, he looks like a bum, so he must be with Occupy Wall Street. He must be with those Occupy people. And, you know,
yeah,
my thought was he got caught in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Well,
that's right. I mean, they're saying, well, maybe he hung out with Occupy Wall Street. Well, but, you know, a lot of people are doing, in essentially that kind of thing, who are homeless or have some mental difficulties. Because it's an easy place, there's food, et cetera. Who wouldn't congregate there?
Yeah, but, you know, the argument was this is why we need to crack down on the occupied people and get rid of them and disband the whole thing. And I said, you know, he got caught in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and that's the home of IUP, Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And so he got caught near a school, so we should probably get rid of education, too, because heaven forbid, he was near the school.
Exactly.
It's just ridiculous to me. And then I heard the other one. Well, his name's, he sounds like a foreigner. Sure you're not a foreigner? Is he here illegally?
Did you really hear that?
I did. I was listening to one guy this morning on the way into work.
It never fails to amaze me.
He's got a foreigner name. We sure he's not here illegally? Going, wow. Scary, scary stuff. But it's been the big distraction. I mean, instead of talking about what's going on around the country and all these people rising up and being angry that we're getting screwed, that was, to me, that was the big distraction.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what they're trying to do is talk about violence with Occupy Wall Street, but you don't really hear the press talking about the issues.
Yeah, and I don't hear much about the fact that an 84-year-old woman was pepper sprayed or maced. You don't hear the beatings that are going on. No, not covering much of that.
No, you don't. Although, actually, I've seen some of the TV people carry some of that.
Yeah, well,
local New York.
Local. If it bleeds there, it leads. So there you go. Let's talk about another
distraction. That's what local TV's about.
There you go. Let's talk about another distraction, this idiotic balanced budget amendment.
Yeah, well, what can I say? They need 290 votes. We know that they at least do not have a very well-known Republican. David Dreyer says he's going to vote against it. They're going to have to get it through. They're going to have to get all of the Republicans, which they're clearly not going to get. Most of them they will. And a fair amount of Democrats, and they're not going to get it. So my guess is that it's sort of another distraction that's going to go down the tubes, although it was part of the deal that was made.
But here's the thing. You knew it was never going to pass the Senate. You know this is not going to happen. We should be talking about how do we create jobs, how do we grow the economy so that our debt-to-GDP ratio goes down as GDP expands. That's kind of seems to me to be the logical position to be taking instead of all of this nonsense. You know, we did the In God We Trust thing. We did the gun thing. Now we've done the balanced budget thing. How about doing the road thing?
Yeah. Roads wouldn't be bad. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, I heard one of my right-wing hosts complaining about, well, why do you have all these people on unemployment? I said, well, some people want jobs, so why not start to do infrastructure?
Yep. I say unemployment should stop after 26 weeks, and instead of unemployment, you give them a job. There's so much work that needs to be done. I drive through the neighborhood that I come to work through. There's houses that need to be painted. There's small amounts of yard work that need to be done. There's a lot of work that we could be doing.
That's for sure. There's a ton of work, and there's no reason in the world not to develop training programs. I mean, for what everybody can say about Haley Bubba or Haley Barber of Mississippi, I do know that after the hurricane, he put in all kinds of training programs. I mean, he's very good at getting federal money to do it, but training programs to train people how to put up wall board, et cetera, do basic carpentry, so that people could start to work on their own communities. It was brilliant.
Yeah, and again, for me, it comes down to there are very positive therapeutic qualities to having a job. It's to me a whole psychological thing. You wake up in the morning with a purpose. You finish the day with a sense of accomplishment. That only snowballs into positive things. You know, because as I see every poll you look at, everybody's all this negativity. Get people back to work. Give them opportunity. Give them a future. We turn this thing around. Pretty simple, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about Patty.
I'm sorry?
Let's talk about Patty Murray, the big super committee. There are people who are hoping it fails. There are people who think it's going to fail. And there are people like me who are fully expecting the Democrats to cave.
Well, that's right. Patty Murray is basically saying, hey, listen, we've met the Republicans for their deal. They have $870 billion that of this 1.2 we've found in reduction in agencies, and et cetera. Then we have $400 billion in revenue. Of that, $250 billion is the tax increase. Well, if you really think about that, that's over 10 years, $25 billion. That's Nothing is tax increase.
You know, the question I have is, you know, you look what's going on in Europe, and I just read an article from The Independent just a bit ago. They're talking about how austerity there has not worked. They've pulled all this money back. They've made all these cuts. And what's happened is their debt has gone up. Their unemployment rates have gone up. And all the negative things have gone up. So they, on the short term, they cut a little spending. But on the long term, they're killing themselves. And I look at what we're doing. We're talking about doing the same things. We should be getting this economy moving again. And once it gets moving, then you start paying the debt down.
For sure. But, yes, and as what people don't realize is that debt is a percentage of the GDP. So if you grow the GDP,
yep,
the debt problem, you know, $15 trillion seems like everybody made a big hoopla about it this week. But what if it is a small percentage? I mean, you know, during the Civil War, $1 billion was a lot of money, and now we wouldn't even think twice of it.
Did you see yesterday's report from this committee on China? And they came out with basically talking about our problems with China and the reality that we're basically screwing ourselves in the worst way. They've got such a huge trade surplus the Chinese have over us, and it's not the cheap stuff that we thought. It's actually the high tech stuff, and the numbers that they threw out. They said something that was like $13 billion of high tech goods we sold in China. And they imported to us something like $85 billion worth of high-tech things. And they went on to say that there are seven industries that they're specifically going to target as their next national champions. And we're just allowing it to happen.
Well, we're allowing that to happen. There was a report that just happened a week before that. I may have mentioned it to you about their spying on all of our different things.
Yep. I mean, there's all of that, and somehow we're just not taking this. Maybe in the halls of Congress, maybe they're really thinking about this. But outwardly, I'm not seeing a posture saying we're not going to take this crap anymore.
No, and because we have a very ambivalent relationship with China, who last month, according to figures released yesterday, had actually increased what they are owning by 1% of everything.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what this whole report went into. And this report should be must read for every person in the country, because it scared the hell out of me, because there's going to be no war. They're just buying us. And this is what this report was saying, that, you know, we're buying all this cheap, all these things, and they're literally buying us, buying our companies, buying up our property, buying our debt. There's going to be nothing left. And the report starts off saying that they're the second largest economy in the world and the world's largest manufacturer. We've already given that title up. 110 years.
Staggering. Staggering. I mean, and we could do, people say, well, we can't do a lot. Well, yes, we could.
Yeah, we could invest in our own technology. We could close off our borders to them and say, if you want to trade, we'll trade on fair terms. We can stop U.S. companies from going over there and partnering up with them, because of this report.
Like General Electric and their X-ray plant.
That's it. And then bringing that stuff back here freely. And then we think, hey, we're buying a GE product. It's an American product made in China. Oh,
well, what can I say? I you're not getting any argument from this part of peanut gallery.
Let's talk about the Solyndra, the Republicans. We're hoping for Solargate. I guess the secretary took the knife.
Well, he did take the knife, and not only did he take the knife, he said, "Look, I wouldn't have made the decision knowing what I know now to fund them." But the fact is that the bottom dropped out of solar plants. A panel, mainly because China is dumping their goods, we know that, for below cost, to run us out of business. And, I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what he clearly meant. And this is what happened. He said, I did not get any political pressure at all. And then they said, well, how come you subordinated regular, you know, investors' debt, subordinated taxpayer debt to investor debt? And he said, because, and why didn't you go to the Justice Department? And he said, well, because my attorney at our department said this was fine.
Yeah, you know, at the end of it, this whole giving subsidies to these big companies to me was a bad idea from the beginning. What we should have done, in my opinion, my humble opinion, we should have said, we're going to buy 1 million solar panels and put it on every government building and on every military installation. Who in the private sector is going to supply us with these American-made solar panels, and this is what we're willing to pay for them?
Right.
That's how it should have gone.
And that puts them in business.
That is how it should have gone. But, you know, we've got this idea that we need economic development money to attract companies. No, we need demand.
Well, I mean, you know, it's the same thing. We bailed out the banks. What if we paid off people's mortgages?
And, you know, I said that when the collapse happened, I said we make the people at the bottom whole and the people at the top will be taken care of as well. Instead of doing what we inevitably did, which was go here, take some money. Please don't crash our economy any worse.
Exactly.
I'm angry. Ellen, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I'm going to tell you that.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann. Even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Yeah, or either that or just crazy. Which, you know, synonymous. Michelle Bachmann, crazy. Yeah, right there. And I think that's one of the things I really like about her. I like the craziness. Because what else would you talk about? She's just a dumb girl? No, I like crazy. She was in Webster City, Iowa yesterday. And she never disappoints. She's talking about her favorite topic, which is Obamacare. And she goes into this rant, which, you know, I guess I should just play part of it. Yeah, let me just play it.
Under Obamacare, illegal aliens don't have to pay for Obamacare.
Nope.
Only American citizens pay for Obamacare.
Oh.
But any official is prohibited from asking someone their residential status.
Oh.
So illegal aliens have the possibility of getting the care, but they have no requirement to pay for the care. Only the citizens do. One man stood up. He was over 7 feet tall. He was a physician in the community. And he said, I had a little lady in my office. She was on Medicare. And because of Obamacare, I had to call the IRS. And I had to get a number to put on a form before I could see her.
Understand. You know, I want to stop her for a second. What she's just saying. A 7 foot doctor, if you believe that. There was a 7 foot doctor. And the 7 foot doctor said that he had to call the government. And this poor little old lady, she had to sit there and wait. And he, the 7 foot doctor. Understand, the IRS does not get involved in any of this stuff until 2014. So much like the woman who told her that the vaccine, the HPV vaccine, caused her daughter to be retarded, and the woman never came forward, I'm assuming that this is really a tall tale, and really a 7 foot tall tale. You know, the 7 foot doctor claim. Understand, the IRS isn't into this. Nothing happens until 2014. There's nothing going on. So none of this can be true. It's not possible. And then, you know, there's a penalty process that people go through. But that goes through your income tax. And it's not going to require a medical provider to call the agency. I mean, it's not real. It's not true. But again, you know, I guess you just make stuff up as you go.
But guess how long I sat on the phone waiting to get this number from the IRS? And he said 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow.
He was sitting on the phone. He couldn't see the woman until he got the patient. Not only did this little lady have to sit and cool her heels for 2 hours and 15 minutes, but meanwhile, all the other patients were stacked up in the waiting room. So that he was waiting on the phone with one bureaucrat. Get a number that long. That's the beginning of what Obamacare is going to be like. I was a little girl. My mom would take us to the doctor. We didn't run to the doctor, as my mom would say. But we did go. And you know how much a doctor's visit was? $5.
$5.
It's $5 when she would take us to the doctor. No. And so we would go, but I also remember that there were people who could not pay. I mean, they just didn't have any money at all. And so the doctor would just write it off.
Oh.
He'd see them, you know, and he knew who was going to abuse the system or not. But the doctor had the freedom, and he would just see somebody and not charge them. That happened all the time in Waterloo.
Wow. Doctor is just doing free stuff. Waterloo must be a great place. You know what I love? Understand what she's saying. A couple of things, but the first thing she's saying is that this little old lady, you have to go through the IRS, and you have to get a number, and the doctor had to stay there for 2 hours and 15 minutes to get this number, to make sure that this woman could get care. Yet right at the beginning, didn't she say this?
Under Obamacare, illegal aliens don't have to pay for Obamacare.
How are they going to get the care if the doctor has to spend 2.5 hours on the phone getting a number? Just a thought. You know, I love her, but she's crazy. And I got this feeling she's got a propensity for making stuff up. They're still looking for the woman whose daughter is retarded because of the HPV vaccine. Probably picked up on the way to the steak shop by the welfare queen driving the Cadillac. I'm sure they're all together having one big party in the car, along with the small family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. I'm sure they're all together, all right there. she's just plain nuts. But again, you know, it takes all kinds, doesn't it? Willie Nelson. How many people like Willie Nelson? Yay! Show of hands. I think I like Willie now, too. The pot smoker, why not? Willie was interviewed on KSAT-TV in San Antonio, Texas, and he said that he was proud of the Occupy movement. He said once people have had enough, they start speaking and they start doing what they're doing, and he says, I'm proud of them for doing it. He says, look, I pay my taxes, and some of those guys up there on Wall Street don't, and those are the ones I'm ticked off at. the ones that make millions of dollars a year and don't pay any taxes. He said, you know, talking about the Republican primary debates, he said it's the best thing on TV. Watching those guys scramble and try and clean up what they've screwed up, it's the best. And I agree with him. I think I agree with Willie. You know, and I sent this around to some of my really right-wing, way-out friends who just think, you know, Willie's just a, he's like Ted Nugent to them on some level. And, you know, I had just talked about it the other, yesterday, about the email I got with him singing What a Wonderful World and them pining for the 1950s. And here's Willie doing what I said yesterday. Raise the taxes on the rich people. Sorry. But Michelle Bachmann, you know, she's got this idea in her head that, you know, that somehow, some way, we're
running out of rich people in this country.
Yeah, we are. We are running out of rich
under
people.
Obama.
Yeah, we're just running out of them. Just, I love her. She's just crazy enough to be entertaining, and just dumb enough to mock. Anyway. Which is why I hope she stays in. And I got to be honest, if she's in this, stop and think about it. You listened to Buddy Romer a little earlier. And then, look, some things we agree on. Obviously, there are going to be things we don't agree on. But if she's on the main stage, shouldn't he be? I mean, just a thought. I look at her and I go, and Santorum, what are they doing there? It makes, to me, almost no sense. Almost no sense at all. Our chart of the day, Goldman Sachs is going to tell us what we're going to get for Christmas. The numbers are in. 63% of the people who responded to the Goldman Sachs survey, well, they're going to buy gift cards this holiday season. While 56% plan on giving clothing, gift cards and jewelry are expected to gain significance and take a bigger part of the wallet share. Toys, you know, clothes, you know, all the regular stuff. But I saw this and I'm going, gift cards? Can you be any less creative? I mean, isn't the whole idea of giving a gift, and I guess this is part of my problem, part of the idea of giving a gift is that you actually put a little thought into it. The reason you buy a present for someone is to say, hey, I think you're special, and this is what I think you would like. If you're going to give me a gift card, keep the gift card. I already know you've put no thought into it. Just give me cash. Because at least the cash doesn't sit in my wallet for an entire year, and then I don't forget about it. I mean, these cards are a scam. Stop it. But again, I go back to this, and I go, you know, it shows me that you obviously don't know me. Why are you buying me a gift? It shows you put no thought into this whatsoever, and save your money. Last story of the day for our friends who like the charter schools and the private schools and the Christian schools, because they know how to treat their workers. They know how to keep them in line. Schaumburg, Illinois. 75-year-old Paul A. LaDuke. Evidently, over the past 10 years, Mr. LaDuke has been, I don't know how to say this without getting into trouble with the FCC. He's been pleasuring himself in front of his class for the last 10 years. Evidently, he's, you know, kind of just, you know, dropping trowel right there, doing his business at the desk. Last 10 years. They have now just come out and fired him. He has been arrested. And I go, you know, it took you 10 years? You can't blame the union for this one. But there you go. Good Christian values. Anyway, if you missed any portion of our program, therickSmithShow.com is where you go to download our podcast. If you got any comments, questions, something on your mind, ticked off by something I said, rick@therickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide.
flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's the Rick Smith Show on... It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
The good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed.